It has the same effect.
Lord Jacobs, she purrs, careful to keep her distance.
I'm quietly glad Elaine isn't with us, having returned to my chambers. Her presence would simply put too much strain on an already stressful situation. Father wastes no time, swooping into a chair like a bird of prey finding a perch. He stares at Cal as he continues pacing.
So, your brother is in enemy hands.
Across the floor, Julian purses his lips.
Enemy is a strong word.
They aren't with us any longer,
Father replies, not bothering to check his tone against anyone.
They stole a valuable hostage. That makes Montfort and the Scarlet Guard our enemies.
Still circling, Cal puts a hand to his chin. He meets Father's gaze.
And what do you propose we do about it, King Volo?
He asks.
You want me to take our still-recovering armies, gather the fleet, and assault a distant nation to win back one useless, broken teenager? I don't think so.
I can almost see the hairs on Father's neck rise. He sets his jaw.
As long as Maven breathes, he's a threat to Norda.
Cal is quick to nod, gesturing with an open palm.
On that we can agree.
Usually any destabilization of Cal's fledgling reign would be cause for celebration, but I find little to cheer here. Instead, I take a seat of my own, leaning back with a huff. Most of the high houses will still swear their loyalty to you, I say aloud, speaking mostly to myself. They know he's finished. Above me, Cal clucks his tongue in a very annoying fashion. I imagine cutting it out of his head.
That isn't good enough. We need a united country if we're going to fight off the Lakelands in Piedmont.
Behind us, Annabelle shuts the door and crosses the room to stand at her grandson's side. Her constant posturing is becoming tedious.
Those bloody rats can't wait for us all to kill each other so they can feed on our corpses.
I sneer up at her, remembering when she first came to the Rift. Then, she pledged that any Red Alliance would be fleeting, and Norda as we knew it would return to its traditions. If I'm not mistaken, I say as innocently as I can, didn't we plan to do the same? She looks at me with disgust as Cal continues his walk. He passes between us, shielding me for a moment. I meet his eyes, locking our gaze for a second. I can't speak, but I try to communicate what I can. He doesn't trust me, doesn't care for me, and I feel the same. But we need each other right now, no matter how much we might despise the thought. He turns away, moving to face my parents again.
We can't lose sight of the true danger right now. The Lakelands will return in full force with Piedmont backing their play.
Who knows what they promised Bracken for his help?
Annabelle curses. On her couch, my mother can't help but sneer.
Well, they didn't ally with the people who kidnapped his children, she says coolly, inspecting her nails, for a start.
I almost expect the Laralan queen to lay hands on my mother, but she doesn't move. Father maneuvers, his voice smooth.
We're quite able to do two things at once, King Tiberius.
Cal responds with his usual fire.
I'm not fighting two wars, Volo, and neither are you.
The command lingers, shocking us all. Even Mother draws back, looking to Father with fear in her eyes. For what he might do, how he could respond to such impudence. They stare each other down, one king against another. The contrast is jarring. Cal is young, a tested warrior but a floundering politician, driven by love, passion, some kind of fire that's always burning inside him. My father is deadly in many ways, with weapons or words. And he is infinitely cold, a calculating statue, his heart nothing but an empty hole. This could end everything, cut the rift from Norda and me with it. But no, Father would never do that. He has plans of his own, plans I cannot fathom, and they hinge on Cal keeping his throne. Father speaks slowly, as if restraining himself.
I'm not talking about a war with Montfort. or the red criminals they conspire with.
He lays his hands flat on his knees, displaying many rings and bracelets, all deadly under his command.
Hit them where it hurts. Take back whatever victory they thought they won here. Be a silver king, a king for your own people.
The singer lord speaks first. I brace myself for his voice, always afraid of the sound.
What are you suggesting?
Father doesn't condescend to look at Julian.
Your proclamations will cripple this country,
he says to Cal.
Erase them.
To my surprise, Julian laughs openly. The sound is oddly kind, a gentle sort of laughter. I'm not familiar with it.
I'm sorry, Your Majesty, but my nephew can't very well reverse what he did today. That isn't strength. That isn't kingly at all.
Now my father turns, fixing Julian with the full weight of his stare.
It's a fitting punishment for their red betrayal.
That strikes a chord in Cal.
I rule in Norda, not you,
he says, careful to speak as clearly as possible.
Or anyone else,
he adds, shooting a meaningful look at both his uncle and his grandmother.
The proclamations remain.
Father's response is quick.
Not in my kingdom.
Like Mother, I feel myself pull back as Cal steps forward, closing the distance between himself and my father. It almost looks like a challenge.
Fine,
he grinds out, glaring at the King of the Rift. Again, they hold each other's gaze, never blinking, never breaking. I wish I could give both of them a shove, destroy all this for good. Annabelle intervenes before either side of the scale can tip. She cuts neatly between the kings, putting a hand to Cal's shoulder.
We'll pick this up in the morning, when we have clearer heads and a better view of the situation.
Behind them, Julian rises to his feet. He adjusts his robes.
I agree, Your Majesty.
Mother sees reason too, and she gestures for Ptolemus to follow. I stand with them, exhausted. Only Father remains sitting. He won't break first. Cal is less inclined to play such games. He turns away, dismissing all of us with a disinterested wave of one hand.
Very well, I'll see you all in the morning.
Then he pauses, looking back. Not at Father, but at me.
Actually, Evangeline, could I have a word?
I blink at him, feeling very sly indeed. The rest of the room could not look more confused.
In private.
Slowly, I sit back down as the rest go. Even Father, who prowls away with the rest of my family in tow. Only Ptolemus looks back, locking eyes with me for a moment. I wave him off. I'll be fine. There's nothing for him to worry about here. Julian is quick to acquiesce to his nephew's wishes, but Annabelle lingers.
Is this something I can help with?
She asks, glancing between us.
No, Annabelle,
Cal replies. He walks with her, deftly herding her toward the door. She notes his intention with a sour twist of her lips, but bows her head. He is her king, and she is bound to obey. When the door shuts behind her, I relax a little, my posture drooping. Cal hesitates, his back to me, and I hear him take a shuddering breath. Crowns are heavy, aren't they? I say to him.
Indeed.
Reluctant, he turns around. Without the pressure to perform for the council and his family, Cal slumps as I do, exhausted by the days, ready to drop. I raise an eyebrow. Worth the price? Cal doesn't respond, walking silently to the chair across from mine. He leans backward, one leg bent, the other stretched. As he moves, I think I hear a click in his knee.
Is yours?
He finally says, gesturing to my empty brow. There isn't any animosity to his words, not like I expect. He's too tired to fight me, and I see no use now in fighting him. No, I don't think so, I mumble back. The admission surprises him.
Are you planning to do anything about it?
he says, voice colored by what could be hope. My plan is to do nothing, I think to myself. There isn't much I can do, I say aloud, not with him holding my leash. He knows who I mean.
Evangeline Samos on a leash, Cal replies, forcing a false smirk. Seems impossible.
I don't have the energy to correct him properly. I wish that were so, is all I can manage. He runs a hand over his face, squeezing his eyes shut for a moment.
Me too.
I have to scoff. The whining of men never ceases to amaze. What leash could there be on the King of Norda? I sneer at him.
More than a few.
You backed yourself into this corner. I shrug, unable to summon any real sympathy for the young man before me. They gave you a choice, one last chance to change things before they left. He bristles, leaning forward on his elbows.
And what would have happened if I'd done what they wanted? Thrown this infernal thing away?
To illustrate his point, he reaches up and grabs his own crown. He discards it with a thunk.
How dramatic. Chaos, riots, maybe another civil war, and certainly war with your father. Maybe my own grandmother, too.
Maybe.
Oh, don't preach to me, Evangeline.
He snaps, really starting to lose his temper.
You can sit here and blame me for all your problems if you want, but don't act like you don't have a hand in them.
I feel warmth rise in my cheeks as I flush.
Excuse me? You've got a choice to, and you keep choosing to stay right here.
Because I'm afraid, Cal. I try to snarl, but it comes out like a whisper. That stills him, just a little. A cool compress over a fresh burn.
So am I,
he says, his voice echoing the pain in mine. Without thinking, I say what I really mean. I miss her, he responds in kind.
So do I.
We're talking about two different people, but the sentiment is the same. He looks down at his hands as if ashamed of the love he feels for someone he cannot have. I know what that agony is like, what an anchor it is, how it will eventually drown us both. If I tell you something, will you promise to keep it a secret? I murmur. Like him, I lean forward until I could take his hands if I wanted. Even from Julian and Annabelle, especially from them. Cal glances up again. He searches my eyes, looking for the trick in me, waiting for whatever Samos trap he thinks I'm about to spring.
Yes.
I lick my lips and speak before my brain can tell me to stop. I think they're going to kill my father. He blinks, confused.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, they won't do it, but for the first time in my life, I take Tiberius Calor's hand and do not hate the sensation. I grip his fingers tightly, trying to make him understand. Do you really think Senra and Iris would trade Maven for someone like Solon Eral?
No, I don't.
Cal breathes. He squeezes my hand, his grasp stronger than mine.
And with your father dead,
I nod as he follows my train of thought. The rift dies with him, returns to Norda, I say. Ptolemus won't have the spine to fight a war with father dead. No matter how good he is at fighting, he isn't meant for it.
I find that hard to believe.
Cal scoffs, his tone changing. Then his eyes shift, brows knitting together, before releasing like a weight cut loose. Realization washes over him.
You haven't told your parents this, have you?
I shake my head. His mouth hangs open.
Evangeline, if you're right, I'm going to let him die.
I know. I hiss to myself, at myself. I snatch my hand away, unable to touch or look at him. Fuming, I stare at the carpeted floor, tracing the fine patterns of red-made artistry. You've always thought me terrible. Is it nice to know you're right? His fingers are hot beneath my chin, tipping my face up to look at him.
Evangeline,
he murmurs, but I don't want his pity. I push him away. I hope the gods of Iris Signet aren't real. I can't imagine what punishments they have in store for me. Cal rests his mouth against his knuckles, idly running his hand back and forth over his lips. Eyes far away, he nods in agreement.
For all of us.
28. Iris. Citadel of the Lakes is the safest place I could ever be, and yet I'm on edge, nervous, constantly looking over my shoulder. I see only familiar guards in their blues, almost blending into the mist of a rainy summer morning. Jadansa is here too, the old Telki trailing my mother and me as we walk the pathways arching over the vast training grounds. She has a calming presence, much like my mother, and I try to relax with them so close. Below us, regiments of the Lakelander army prepare for war. Those who have already fought, legions ceded to Maven while we were allied, have earned some well-needed rest. The soldiers here are fresh, ready to fight, eager to win a country for the glory of the Lakelands. The hills and rivers, the beaches of Norda, their powerful tech towns, bursting with electricity and economic value. The kingdom of Norda is a gold mine just waiting to be claimed. Thousands upon thousands of soldiers drill in the rain, unbothered by the wet weather. The same will be true across our kingdom. From Citadel of the Snows to Citadel of the Rivers, the call has gone out. We are mobilizing all we can gather, silver and red. The army of the Lakelands is assembled and ready to strike. We have the numbers, we have the abilities. Our enemy is already crippled, and we need only put it out of its misery. So why do I feel so unsettled, deep in my heart? Reviewing troops doesn't require royal finery, and both of us are dressed like the soldiers we support, in blue uniforms edged with glinting silver and gold. Even Mother has stopped wearing her mourning blacks. But we haven't forgotten Father, or our vengeance. It weighs on us all like a heavy stone. I feel it with every step. We cross the last bridge, stepping onto one of the many balconies ringing the central structure of the citadel. The windows glow, beckoning with warmth. Despite the calming effect of the rain, I'm eager to get out of the weather. My mother moves quickly, setting our pace, and leads us inside. We're supposed to meet Tiora for lunch, but by the time we reach the room prepared for our meal, she still isn't there. It isn't like my sister to be late. I glance at my mother for some kind of explanation, but she merely takes her seat at the head of the table. If Queen Senra isn't bothered by Tiora's absence, then I won't be either. Like Mother, I take my seat, ready to wait for Tiora to arrive. The guards hang back at the door, taking up flanking positions, but Jadansa sits. She is a noble of the Meren line, an ancient and distinguished family here in the Lakelands, and she has served us for many years. While the queen helps herself to some fluffy bread, I inspect the vast array of silverware, forks, spoons, knives especially. I count the possible weapons on the table out of habit, careful to include the filled water glasses, more deadly than any knife in my hands. I stare at the water, letting it fill my perception as it fills each glass. The sense is as familiar as my own face, but somehow different now. After what I helped my mother do. It's been days since we made our trade, and I can't get it out of my head. The sound especially. How the Eral lord choked on his last breaths, unable to fight us off. The Kalor king's uncle, someone named Jakos, is a singer, and he removed any fight from the man before we could get our hands on him. Maybe if he could have fought back, I wouldn't feel so strange. He deserved to die. Deserved worse punishment than we gave. But the memory still fills me with a strange, foreign sense of shame, as if I have betrayed the gods in some way, gone against their will and their nature. I'll pray some more tonight, and hope to find an answer in their wisdom. Eat, before the food gets cold, Mother says, gesturing to the plates before us. Tiora will be with us in a moment. I nod and move mechanically, serving myself. Precautions have to be taken. No red servants, not while we discuss the path ahead. The Scarlet Guard has ears and eyes everywhere. We must be vigilant. Most of the meal is fish, butterfly trout, sliced open and fried with butter and lemon, yellow perch, crusted with pepper and salt, a warming stew of lamprey eel, the heads removed and proudly displayed at the center of the table. Their rows of spiraling teeth gleam in the soft light of the dining room. The other plates hold ears of golden corn, greens tossed in spiced oil, braided breads. The usual bounty from Lakelander crops. Our farms are far-flung and prosperous, able to feed our country twice over. Lakelanders never want for food, not even the lowest red. I help myself to a little of each, careful to leave the lamprey for Tiora. It's an acquired taste, not to mention her favorite. Another minute goes by in silence, marked only by the kindly ticking of a clock on the wall. Outside, the rain picks up, lashing the windows in merciless sheets. The army should break until this clears, I mutter. No use letting our soldiers get sick and feed an epidemic of colds. True, Mother replies around bites of food. She tips a hand at Jidunsa, who stands quickly. She ducks into a curt bow. I'll make it so, Your Majesty, she says before setting off to deliver the order. The rest of you, wait outside, my mother continues, glancing at each of our guards in turn. They don't hesitate, almost leaping to follow her commands. I watch the room empty, my nerves prickling. Whatever Mother wants to say to me isn't meant for an audience. When the door shuts again, leaving us alone, she steeples her fingers together and leans forward. It isn't the rain that bothers you, mon amour. For a second, I debate denying it, pasting on a smile, forcing a laugh and a dismissal. But I don't like to wear masks with my mother. It's dishonest. And besides, she sees right through them. I sigh, setting aside my fork. I keep seeing his face. She softens, wavering from queen to mother. I miss your father, too. No! The word stumbles out, too quick, startling my mother. Her eyes widen a little, darker than usual in the dim light. I do think about him all the time, but... I search for the proper way to say this. Instead, I put it bluntly. I'm talking about the man who killed him. Who we then killed, Mother says, her voice even. It isn't an accusation, but a simple statement of fact. At your suggestion. Once more, I feel rare shame. A flush creeps over my cheeks. Yes, it was my idea to take up Queen Annabelle's offer, to trade Maven for the man who killed my father, and later on the man he killed my father for. But that part of the bargain has yet to be paid. I do it again, I mutter, playing with my food for some distraction. I feel exposed beneath my mother's gaze. He deserves to die 100 times, but... She tightens, as if in pain. You've killed before, in defense of your own life. I open my mouth to try to explain, only to find her still speaking. But not like that, she adds, laying one hand on mine. Her eyes shine, full of understanding. No, I admit, bitter and disappointed in myself. This was a righteous kill. Payment for the death of my father. It shouldn't be this way. Mother's fingers grip mine. Of course it would feel different, feel wrong somehow. My breath catches in my throat as I stare at our joined hands. Will it go away? I murmur, forcing myself to look back up at her. But Mother isn't looking at me. She glances out the window into the obscuring rain. Her eyes dance with the lashing water. How many people has she killed, I wonder? I have no way of knowing and no way of finding out. Sometimes, she finally says. Sometimes not. Before I can tug on that thread to unravel exactly what she means, Tiora enters the room, her own guards left behind in the hallway, like ours. While Mother came to Norta briefly, against all traditions of the Lakelands, Teora stayed behind to keep our nation's borders safe, and our armies ready for the next step in our journey. She was well-suited to the job, and it seems to cheer her, even as we leap between wars. The heiress to the Lakelander throne looks just like another soldier, her uniform wrinkled, without any livery or insignia to it. She could be a simple messenger, if not for the signet look, high cheekbones, and a higher opinion of oneself. She sits with our father's grace, folding her long limbs into the chair across from mine. "Lovely, I'm famished," she says, picking at the spread with both hands. I nudge the stew in her direction, along with the display of lamprey heads. As children, we used to throw them at each other. Teora remembers, and she offers a tiny grin in reply. Then she gets down to business, facing our mother with the gravity of a general. "We have word from snows, hills, trees, rivers, and plains," she says, rattling off the other citadels dotting the vast expanse of the Lakelands. "All are ready." Queen Senra nods, pleased by the news. "As they should be. The time to strike is coming, and coming soon." The time to strike. We've spoken of nothing else since I returned to my homeland. I haven't even had time to enjoy my freedom beyond the bounds of Maven's kingdom or his marriage. Mother has me in endless meetings and reviews. After all, I'm the only one of us to have faced Tiberius and his contingent of unknown red soldiers, not to mention his Rift allies. We have Bracken and Piedmont on our side, yes. But is he a better ally than Maven was? A better shield against the Kalor brother now on the throne? Is it even any use to wonder? Our decision is long since made. Maven is a card we've already played and traded off. Teora forges on. "More importantly, it seems Tiberius Kalor's newly made kingdom is splintering again." I blink at her, forgetting the food on my plate. "How so?" "The Reds are no longer with them," she replies. I feel myself twitch in surprise. "According to our intelligence reports, the Scarlet Guard, that strange new blood, and the Montfort armies have all disappeared. Returned to the mountains, we think, or gone underground." At the head of the table, Mother sighs aloud. She raises one hand, massaging her temple. "When is anyone going to learn that young kings are fools?" Teora smirks in amusement, enjoying Mother's show of female frustration. I'm more interested in the implication of Red desertion. Without Montfort, the New Bloods, the spies of the Scarlet Guard, without Mare Barrow, the scales have certainly tipped against Tiberius Kalor. And it isn't difficult to understand why. "The Reds won't support him on the throne," I say. I didn't know Mare well, but I saw enough of her to guess. She fought Maven at every turn, even as a prisoner. Surely she wouldn't stomach another king. They must have had an agreement to win the country back and build anew. Tiberius refused his end of the bargain. Silver is still rule in Norsa. After a bite of lamprey, Teora shakes her head. "Not entirely. There have been proclamations, more rights for the Reds of Norta, better wages, the end of forced labor. They've stopped conscription, too." My eyes widen, mostly out of shock, but also from unease. If Reds across the border are offered such boons, what will happen to Reds in the Lakelands? It will be an exodus, a mad dash. "We have to close our borders," I say quickly. "Stop any Reds from crossing into Norta." Again, Mother sighs. "He's truly an idiot," she mutters. "Of course, we'll double our watch at the northern border. Leave it to a Kalor to cause us more headaches." Teora hums low in her throat. "He's causing himself headaches as well. Their tech towns are draining as we speak. I assume any economic might they have now will soon follow." At that, our mother almost laughs to herself. I would join her if I could. All I can think about is the magnificent stupidity of Tiberius Kalor. He's only just won back his throne, and now he seeks to strip his country of its greatest strengths? For who? Some red-blooded nobodies? For the myth of equality, justice, honor, or whatever other foolish ideal he hopes to achieve. I scoffed to myself. I wonder if the Kalor King, left to his own devices, will simply drown under the weight of his crown, or be devoured by the Rift King, scheming to leech what he can from the so-called Flame of the North. He won't be the only silver in the Norden territories to chafe under the proclamations. I feel a smirk curl on my lips, twisting to one side as I think. I doubt the silvers of Norta will like that, I say, waving a finger over my water glass. Inside, the liquid swirls with my motions. Mother eyes me, trying to follow my train of thought. Indeed. I could reach out to a few of them, I continue, the plan coming as quickly as I speak it. Offer condolences, or incentives. If some could be swayed, just a few key regions, Mother says, seeming to light up. I nod. Then this war will be over in a single battle. Archaon falls, and Norta with it. Across from me, Teora pushes her favored stew away. What about the Reds? I gesture to her with an open hand. You said it yourself. They've gone to ground, retreated, left Norta open for the taking. Grinning, I glance between my mother and sister. All thoughts of the Iral Lord and his death seem to evaporate from my mind. We have more important things to worry about. And we have to take it. For the gods, Teora breathes, gently hitting her fist against the table. I stifle the urge to correct her. Instead, I dip my head to my older sister. For our own protection. She blinks, confused. Our protection? We sit here, serving our own lunch, for fear of the Scarlet Guard. Reds surround us, in our nation and outside it. If their rebellion continues to spread, hungry as a cancer, where will that leave us? I brush my fingers over the plates and cups, then gesture to the empty room and windows. The rain has lessened, easing to a steady pattern of drips. In the distance, to the west, the sun breaks through the gray clouds in tiny spatters of light. And what about Montfort? An entire country of Reds and those strange new bloods set against us? We have to defend ourselves, make ourselves too big and too strong to challenge. Neither of you has been there. You haven't seen their city, high in the mountains, red and silver and new blood joined together, and stronger for the joining. It was easy to sneak into Ascendant to rescue Bracken's children, but I can't imagine an army doing the same. Any war with Montfort will be bloody for both sides. It must be prevented, made impossible, before it can even begin. I steel myself. Give them no chance to rise up or stand against us. Mother is quick to respond. Agreed. Agreed. Teora offers with the same speed. She even raises her glass, the clear liquid turning in the faceted cup. Outside, as the rain ebbs to nothing, I feel a bit calmer. Still anxious about what is to come, but satisfied by the plan taking shape. If Maven's houses can be made loyal to us, then Tiberius will be severely hobbled, losing allies left and right. Alone on the throne is no place for anyone to be. Maven was alone too, no matter how many advisors and nobles surrounded him. I'm glad he never tried to make me share his empty hours, at least not more than was necessary. He frightened me when he was alive. He was an impossible person to predict. I never knew what he might say or do, and it forced me to live on edge. I've only just begun to catch up on all the sleep lost in his palace, too close to the monstrous king for comfort. I'm surprised they didn't execute him publicly, I muse aloud, my voice low. I wonder how they did it. I see Maven in my head, struggling weakly against our guards. He didn't see it coming. I'm impossible to predict, too. My sister dips her spoon in the lamprey stew, not eating, but pushing the liquid back and forth. It sloshes, filling the silence. What is it, Teora? Mother prods, seeing right through her display. Teora hesitates, but not for long. There's been some speculation about that, she says. He hasn't been seen or heard from since he was taken to the palace in Harbor Bay. I shrug. Because he's dead. Teora doesn't look at me. Can't look at me. Our spies don't think so. Despite the warmth of the room and the food, I feel a sudden chill deep in my chest. I swallow hard, trying to understand, and ignore the fear threatening to return. Don't be a coward. He's far away, imprisoned if not dead. He's not your problem anymore. My mother shares none of my terror. She just blusters. Why keep him alive? I swear, these Kalor brothers are trying to out-idiot each other. I try to be more thoughtful. I speak if only to mask my unease. Perhaps the older brother can't do it. He seemed soft-hearted. He must be, to allow himself to be so manipulated by a red girl. Teora is just as observant as our mother, and she tries to be gentle as she explains. There are rumors that Maven isn't there anymore. The Queen of the Lakelands blanches. Well, where could he be? There are few options, and I run through them quickly. Of course, one is more obvious than the rest, and woefully awful for that lightning girl. At least I escaped to Maven Kalor. She, it seems, cannot. I suspect Montfort, I say. He's with the New Bloods and the Scarlet Guard. With Mayor Barrow. Teora bobs her head, thinking as she nods. So when the Reds left, he's a valuable hostage, yes, I tell her. If Maven is still alive, Tiberius is vulnerable. Nobles might still be loyal to his brother. Mother surveys me like an advisor, not a daughter. It thrills me, and I feel my spine straighten, flattening my back against my seat as I draw up to my full height. Do you think that's possible? She asks. I chew on the answer for a moment, weighing what I know of Norta and its silvers. I think those silver houses just want a reason not to back Tiberius, to hold on to their country as it was. Both my mother and Teora, a queen and the queen-to-be, watch me silently. I raise my chin. I say we give them a reason.
29. Mayor. It's nightfall when we reach Ascendant, gliding through the mountains in almost pitch darkness. I try not to think about being smashed against the black slopes, but the pilots are skilled, landing our airjet on the Alpine runway with ease. The rest of Montfort's air fleet, as well as the transport convoys carrying the bulk of their army, is down on the plain. They'll have to climb the Hawkway to get to the city, or disperse along other roads and travel routes throughout Montfort to return to their posts. The country will then take up defensive positions, guarding its own borders. On the off chance the Lakelanders decide to try their might against the mountains, or prod the raiders and prairie into doing their work for them. Farley, Davidson, their attendants, and I make the trek into the city in silence, walking the steps beneath an arc of glittering starlight. I watch the sky as we go, trying to name the constellations. I refuse to think about either Kalor brother, not the one we left in Norta, nor the one marching with us, bound in chains, held at gunpoint. He chatters occasionally, asking questions about Montfort. No one answers. And his voice dies slowly, left to echo into nothing. Before we reach the Premier's home, Maven is taken away, down another flight of steps, where more guards appear to flank him. Montfort won't risk losing another prisoner. Maven won't get the gentle treatment given to Bracken's children. He will be taken deep into the city, to the prison below the Ascendant main barracks. I try not to watch his silhouette as it grows smaller and smaller. He never looks back. Farley outpaces everyone, even Killorn and his long strides. I don't have to be a mind reader to guess her thoughts are of her daughter, left behind with the rest of our family. Davidson was good enough to send word on ahead, so his palatial home is ablaze when we approach, the many windows and balconies lit by warm candles and lights. Familiar figures cast shadows across the stones, and we beeline for them. My mother hands off Clara, the baby girl sleepy but smiling, as Farley lifts her up. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Davidson embrace his husband, Carmadon, before my mom does the same to me. Her arms squeeze my shoulders tightly, and she hugs me to her chest with a deep sigh. I relax as I only can with the rest of my family, letting them usher us inside and up to our rooms. The reunion is sentimental as ever, even though it's become a habit. I leave, face death, and against all odds, return in one piece. I know my parents would tie me down to stop me from repeating the cycle, if they thought it might work. But they trust me to make my own choices. And besides, I'm a new blood. The Lightning Girl. There are very few bonds that can hold me back. No matter how much I might want to stay, the need to move on, to keep fighting, is always stronger. Farley disappears into her own bedroom, Clara on her hip, with an exhausted smile. No one stops her. She needs time alone with her daughter, and we're all happy to give it. Instead, my family filters onto the tiled terrace, which is bursting with more flowers than I remember. Tramie has been busy. They're beautiful, I tell him, gesturing to a lovely array of white blooms curling up and over the railing. He heaves himself into a chair with a bashful grin, and Gisa perches on the arm of the seat. I plop down next to them both, content to sit on a flat, squashy cushion set on the tile. Mom helped, Tramie says, gesturing across to her. At the edge of the terrace, she waves a hand. Her hair is down tonight. I'm used to long years of my mother in twisted braids and neat buns, always keeping her hair out of her face. Despite the gray, she looks younger like this. I just followed you around with a watering can, she says. I've never considered Ruth Barrow beautiful. How could anyone, let alone a poor red woman, be considered beautiful next to Silver's? But Montfort brings a glow to her, a healthiness in her golden skin that makes it gleam. Even her wrinkles seem lessened, softened by the gentle lamplight. Of course, Dad looks better than ever, hardier than he was in the stilts. He's gained weight where he needs to, arms and legs filling out, while his waist looks trimmer. I chalk it up to nutrition, and of course, his replaced leg and lung. After he greets me, he settles into his usual gruff silence, claiming a seat of his own next to Bree. The weeks have been good to all of them, especially Gisa. Her dark red hair glints like oil in the dim light. I take in her clothing, a repurposed Montfort uniform, but the cuffs and collar are heavily embroidered in swirls of colored thread, pricking out a pattern of flowers and purple-bright zags of lightning. I reach out to her, running my fingers over her careful handiwork. I can make you one, if you like, she says, eyeing my own uniform. The offensively bright red of the Scarlet Guard outfit makes her wrinkle her nose. Maybe downplay all this, she mutters, waving her hands a little. Give you something a little better than medals. Killorn eases himself down next to me, leaning back on his hands with his legs crossed. Do I get one too? If I feel like it, Gisa replies with her usual sniff. She eyes him up and down, as if assessing a customer. Fish instead of flowers, I think. I can't help but chuckle into my hand, grinning at Killorn's exaggerated pout.
So how long will you be here this time? My father's voice is still a low grunt, full of accusation.
I glance at him, meeting his dark brown eyes, the same eyes as Bree and Tramie, darker than my own. Mom puts a hand on his shoulder, as if she can push him off the subject. Daniel, she just got back. He doesn't look at her.
That's my point.
It's fine, I murmur, glancing between them. It's an honest question, and a good one, especially based on recent circumstances. To tell you the truth, I don't know. It could be days, could be weeks, could be months. My family seems to brighten with each larger measurement of time. It pains me to give them what could be false hope, even though I want it to be true. We still don't know how things will proceed. Dad purses his lips. With Norta. I shake my head. With the Lakelands, mostly. The others look on, silent as I explain, except for Kalorn. His brow furrows slowly, creasing his forehead with deep, angry lines. They hold all the power right now. Cal is still consolidating a torn country, and we're waiting to see how everything shakes out. If the Lakelands strike, my oldest brother draws an angry breath before pushing it out in an exasperated sigh. He glares at me because there's simply no one else to glare at.
You'll help fight them off?
As with Dad, I hear an accusation in him. I can only shrug. It isn't me he's frustrated with, but the situation I keep finding myself in. Pulled toward danger, torn between silver kings, a weapon to be wielded, a face to be used. I don't know, I mutter. We aren't allied to him anymore. At my side, Kalorn shifts, uncomfortable on the tile. Or the subject. And what about the other one? Around the cluster of chairs, my family blanches in varying levels of confusion. Mom crosses her arms over her chest, fixing me with a piercing stare I know all too well. Who? She asks, even though she knows. She just wants to make me say it. Gritting my teeth, I force an answer. He means Maven. My father's voice turns deadly, like I've never heard it before. He should be dead by now. He's not, and he's here. Kilorn snarls before I can stop him. A pulse of fury thrums through my family. Every face turning red, every lip curling, all eyes sharpening with glints of rage. Kilorn, don't start trouble, I hiss, squeezing his wrist. But the damage is already done. The silence around our circle runs heavy with scarlet anger, so strong I can almost taste it. Finally, Gisa speaks. Her tone as feral as my father's.
We should kill him.
My sister is not a violent girl, better suited to a needle than a knife. But she looks like she could claw Maven's eyes out if given the opportunity. I would feel guilty for bringing this anger out in her, but I can't get beyond the sudden swell of love, appreciation, and pride. My brothers nod slowly, agreeing with her sentiment. They might even be cooking up some harebrained attempt to get into Maven's cell right now. He's valuable alive, I say quickly, if only to stop them short.
I don't give a shit about his value, Bree snaps.
I expect our mother to scold him for his language, but she isn't bothered by the curse. In fact, she looks positively murderous herself, and for an instant, I see the violent love of Queen Annabelle, Laurentia Viper, and even Ilara Mirandis in her eyes.
That creature took my son from me. And he took you.
I'm right here, Mom, I murmur, swallowing around the sudden painful memory of Shade.
You know what I mean, she says. I'll slit his throat myself.
Most shocking of all is Dad's silence. He's a naturally quiet man, but not when it comes to despising silvers. When I glance at him, I realize why he won't say anything, because he can't. His face is a furious red, boiling with a steady, rising hatred. If he opens his mouth, who knows what might tumble out.
Can we talk about something else?
I have to ask, looking around at the rest of my family.
Please do.
Dad barely manages through gritted teeth. You all look well, I say quickly. His Montfort mom seems annoyed, but dips her head in acceptance. She answers for all of them, cutting me off.
It's a dream, Mare.
My natural suspicion flares, in spite of all I know about Davidson. But I don't know his country or his city. I don't know the politicians he serves or the people they represent. Is it too good, though? I ask, Do you think we'll wake up to find ourselves in trouble? To find something gone horribly wrong? She heaves a heavy sigh, looking out at the sparkling lights of Ascendant. I suppose we should always be wary. But I don't think so, Dad offers, neatly finishing her thought. His words are few, but expressive. This place is different. Gisa nods along with them. I've never seen reds and silvers together like this. Back in Norta, when I went to sell with my mistress, silvers wouldn't even look at us, wouldn't touch us. Her brown eyes, the same as mine, glaze a little as she remembers her life as it was so long ago, before a silver officer smashed apart her sewing hand. Not here. In his seat, Tremi settles back, some of his ire melting away, like a cat smoothing his fur after a scare. We feel like equals. I can't help but wonder if it's because of me, their family to the Lightning Girl, a valuable asset to the Montfort Premier. Of course they'd be treated well. But I don't say any of that out loud, if only to maintain some kind of peace on an otherwise tumultuous night. After that, the conversation becomes far more pleasant. Servants, kindly and smiling, bring up a sizable spread for dinner. The food is simple, but rich and tasty, ranging from fried chicken to sugary dark purple berries spread over toast. The food is mostly for my benefit and Killorn's, but Bree and Tremi help themselves to full portions. Gisa favors a tray of fruits and cheeses, while Dad fixes himself a plate of cold meats and crackers to share with Mom. We eat slowly, talking more than chewing. I mostly listen, letting my siblings regale me with stories of their explorations throughout Ascendant. Bree swims in the lake every morning. Sometimes he wakes up Tremi with it too, dumping a bottle of icy water on his head. Gisa has an almost scientific knowledge of the shops and markets, as well as the grounds of the Premier's compound. She likes to walk the high meadows with Tremi, while Mom prefers the gardens in the city, terraced down the slopes. Dad has been honing his walking abilities, going deeper and deeper into the valley every day, strengthening his new muscles, and relearning two legs with every step down and every step back up. Killorn fills in as well as he can, detailing our exploits since we left Montfort last. It's a sparse recollection, and he is gracious enough to leave out the more embarrassing or upsetting details, including any mention of Cameron Cole. For Gisa's sake, but judging by the way she spoke about a young girl and the jeweler's shop she worked in, I think her old crush on my best friend has passed. Eventually, my eyelids begin to droop. It's been a long, difficult day. I try not to remember how I woke up this morning, in the dark of Cal's royal bedchamber, his blankets over my body. Tonight, I'll sleep in a bed by myself. Not alone, though. Gisa will be just across the room. I still can't sleep without someone else there. Or at least, I haven't tried since I escaped Maven's imprisonment. Don't think about him. I chant it to myself as I prepare for bed, repeating the words over and over. Cal's face seems burned against my eyelids, while Maven haunts even my fleeting, distant dreams. Those stupid boys. They never leave me alone. In the morning, my nerves twitch with energy. It's a constant pull, a tug behind my stomach, like someone has a hook around my spine. I know where it wants me to go. Down into the city, toward the central barracks of Ascendant. The structure squats over the city prison, drilled into the bedrock of the mountainside. I try not to picture him, alone behind bars, pacing like a dying animal. Why I want to see him, I can hardly understand. Maybe some part of me knows he's still useful, or wants to understand him a little more, before time runs out. We're alike in some ways. Too many ways. I've tasted darkness, and he lives in it. He represents what I could become, without my family, without an anchor, if I'm pushed into the abyss. But Maven is the abyss. I can't face him. Not yet. I'm not strong enough to do it. He'll just laugh in my face, taunt and torture, turning the screws embedded too deeply. I need to heal a bit before he can pick open my wounds again. So instead of walking down into the city, I go up and up and up. At first I follow the road we took over the mountain when the raiders struck down on the plain. We now know that it was a planned attack, meant to distract us while the Lakelanders rescued Prince Bracken's children. The raiders were paid to do it, and paid well. I kick at stones as I go, replaying the battle in my mind. The silence clawed at my body, like something alive and unnatural beneath my skin, replacing my lightning with emptiness. Cursing, I push the thought away and turn off the road, into the rocks and trees. The hours pass, and the air seems to burn in my lungs, searing down my throat. It's matched only by the fire in my muscles. They scream with each new step, every foot forward and upward over the rocks. Snow puddles in the shadows, white and pure even in the late summer. It turns even colder as I climb, my feet sliding over dirt and pine needles, gravel and naked rock. In spite of the pain, I push on. Streams trickle past, running down the mountainside to pool in the lake far below. I look back through the gaps in the pines, into the valley. The mountains dwarf Ascendant, and the foreign capital looks like a child's toy from this distance. White blocks strewn around ribbon-thin roads and winding stairs. The mountain range seems endless, a jagged wall of stone and snow dividing the world in half. Above, the clear blue sky beckons to me to continue the climb. I do my best, stopping at the streams to drink and splash my red, sweaty face. Occasionally, I fish out crackers from my pack or strips of salted meat. I wonder if the smell might lure a bear or wolf across my path. I have my lightning, of course, close as the breath in my lungs, but no predator ever comes near. I think they know I'm as dangerous as they are. All except for one. At first I mistake him for an outcropping of rock, silhouetted against the perfect blue, still in gray clothing. The pines are sparser at this high altitude, offering little shade from the noon sun. I have to blink, rubbing my eyes, before I realize what I'm looking at. Who I'm looking at. My lightning splits the granite boulder beneath him in two. He moves before it strikes, sliding off into the rocks. You bastard, I snarl, advancing with speed, the adrenaline sudden and surging in my blood. It drives me, as does frustration, because I know, no matter how fast I am, no matter how strong my lightning, I'll never catch him. John will always see me coming. His laughter echoes over the slope, coming from higher up. I snarl to myself and follow the sound, letting him lead me. He laughs and laughs, and I climb and climb. By the time we're out of the trees, over earth, too high for anything to grow, the air has turned harsh and cold. I choke down a gasp of anger, letting the temperature shock my lungs, and I slump, unable to go any farther, unwilling to let John or anyone control where I go and what I do. But mostly, I'm just exhausted. I lean back, bumping against a large boulder, smothered by centuries of unforgiving wind and snow. My breathing comes hard and heavy. I think I might never catch my breath, just as I'll never catch the damned seer.
The altitude, his voice says. It makes everything difficult if you aren't used to it. Even your fire prince would have a hard time climbing his first mountain.
I'm too tired to do much more than glance at him, eyes half-lidded. He perches above me, legs dangling. John is dressed for the mountain weather, in a thick coat, with well-worn boots on his feet. I wonder how long he's been walking, or how long he had to wait up here for me. You know as well as I do he isn't a prince anymore, I answer, choosing my words very carefully. Maybe I can get him to reveal something, just a sniff of the future ahead of us all. Just like you know how long he'll be a king.
Yes, he replies, smirking slightly.
Of course he knows what I'm doing, and he says only what he intends to say. I heave another heavy breath, sucking air into my starved lungs. What are you doing here?
Taking in the view.
He still hasn't looked at me, his red eyes trained on the horizon. The sight before us is amazing, more splendid than it was 1,000 feet below. I really do feel small and large, everything and nothing, sitting here on the rim of the world. My breath fogs before my eyes, a testament to the chill. I can't stay long, not if I want to get down before nightfall. I wish I could take John's head with me. I told you this would happen, he murmurs. Snarling, I bare my teeth at him. You didn't tell me anything. My brother might be alive if you did. Thousands of people. Have you considered the alternative? He snaps. That what I did, what I said and didn't say, did and didn't do, saved more. I ball a fist and kick my foot, sending a shower of gravel skittering down the slope. Have you considered just keeping your nose out of everything? John barks a laugh. Many times. But whether I involve myself or not, I see the path. I see the destination. And sometimes I just can't let it happen. So nice you get to decide, I sneer, bitter as I always am with the wretched new blood. Would you like the burden, Mayor Barrow? John replies, lowering himself down so we sit side by side. He smiles sadly. I didn't think so. I shudder beneath his crimson attention. You told me I would rise and rise alone, I mutter, repeating the words he spoke so long ago, in an abandoned coal town half shrouded by the rain. That was my fate, and I've watched it become truer with every passing day. When I lost Shade, when I lost Cal, but also in the steady detachment, the cold hand that seems to worm itself between me and everyone else I love. No matter how hard I try to ignore it, I can't help but feel different, broken and angry, and therefore alone, with only one person left who truly understands. And he is a monster. I lost Maven, too, the person he pretended to be, the friend I loved and needed when I was so alone and so afraid. I've lost so many people. But I've gained many. Farley, Clara, my family is still with me, safe but for Shade. Killorn, never wavering in his loyalty and friendship. I have the Electricons, new bloods like me, who prove I am not alone. Premier Davidson, and all he hopes to do. They outnumber everyone I've lost. I don't think you were right, I mumble, half believing the words. Next to me, John jolts, his neck cracking as he looks at me sharply. Or has that path changed too? Even though I hate his eyes, I force myself to stare into them, to look for a lie or the truth. Did I change it? He blinks slowly. You changed nothing. I feel like elbowing him in the throat, or the gut, or the skull. Instead, I slump backward, tipping my head to glare at the sky. John watches, chuckling a little. What? I snarl, eyeing him. Rise, he murmurs, pointing to the valley, thousands of feet below. Then he points to my chest. And rise alone. This time I bat his arm weakly, wishing I could inflict more hurt on the seer. I know you weren't talking about climbing a mountain, I growl. No longer the lightning, but the storm. The storm that will swallow the world entire. He just rolls his shoulders and looks out to the range again, his breath steaming in the cold air. Who knows what I was talking about? You do. And I'll keep that weight to myself. Thank you very much. No one else needs it. I scoff. You act as if you enjoy lording our fates over us. Chewing my lip, I weigh my chances again. A hint from him could be infinitely valuable or damning, throwing me onto a path of his choosing. I simply have to take the chance and consider what he says with a mountain of salt. Any more choice words, little nudges, you might condescend to give? The corner of his mouth lifts, but his eyes waver, almost sad.
Your friend is better at fishing than you.
Cold air whistles down my throat as I inhale sharply. What do you know about Killorn? I ask, my voice climbing an octave. Killorn is no one to John, no one to grand movements of kingdoms and fate. He shouldn't take up an inch of space in John's head, not in comparison to the thousands of dangerous and horrible things he does keep in there. I move to grab his arm, but he shifts neatly from my touch. His red eyes stare, like twin drops of blood.
He's the catalyst for all this, isn't he? For your part in it, at least.
He says,
the poor friend doomed to conscription, with only you to save him.
John's words are slow, methodic, deliberate, giving me time to put together the pieces of this part of the puzzle. I try not to know, try not to accept what is staring me in the face. I want to kill him, smash his head against the rock, but I can't move. Because he lost his apprenticeship, I say, trembling. Because Killorn's master died.
Because Killorn's master fell.
It isn't a question. John knows exactly what happened to old Cully, the fisherman my best friend used to serve. A simple man, gray before his years, just like the rest of us. Tears fill my eyes. I've been a puppet for too long, even longer than I thought possible.
You pushed him. I push many people in many different ways.
Did you push an innocent man to his death? I seethe. Something switches in him, like a lamp turning off or on, shifting his focus. He gathers himself and sniffs, his voice suddenly clear, more forceful, as if he is addressing a crowd of soldiers rather than just me.
The Lakelands will strike Archaon soon, he says. Within a few weeks. They're preparing as we speak, drilling their armies past the point of perfection. Tiberius Killorn is weak, and they know it.
I don't have the heart or stomach to argue. He's right, and I'm still reeling.
If they take the city, Tiberius will never win Norta. Not this year, not the next, not even 100 years from now.
I clench my teeth. You could be lying. He ignores me, forging on.
If the capital falls to the Queen of the Lakelands, the road becomes long and bloody, worse than anything you've experienced before.
In his lap, he knits his fingers together, knuckles going white against the gray of his clothes.
Even I can barely see the ending of that path, but I know it's terrible.
I don't like being your chess piece.
Everyone is someone else's pawn, Mare, whether we know it or not.
Whose pawn are you? He doesn't respond, only raising his eyes to the clear, cold sky. With a final sigh, he pushes himself to his feet, dislodging rocks with the motion.
You should get moving, he says, gesturing down the mountain.
So I can pass on your message? I snap, sounding bitter. Taking John's orders is the last thing I want to do right now, even if he's right. I think I'd rather freeze than give him the satisfaction.
So you can avoid that,
he replies. With his chin, he points off to the north, where a band of clouds gathers across the peaks.
Storms move quickly up here.
I can handle storms.
Do as you wish, John replies, shrugging.
He pulls his coat tighter around himself.
We will not see each other again, Mare Barrow.
Still on the ground, I sneer up at him.
Good.
He doesn't respond and turns around to continue his climb. I watch his figure grow smaller, a gray man against gray stone, until he disappears. To rise and rise alone. The storm breaks on the summit as soon as I step into the protection of the tree line, escaping a howl of wind and freezing rain. It hurts almost as much as going up, my knees jarring with the hard impact of every step. I have to be careful and focus on where I put my feet, lest I break an ankle on the loose stones and pine needles piled over the trail. Above me, back up the mountain, a low thrum of thunder peals, alive as my own beating heart. I reach ascendant as the sun first sinks beneath the peaks across the valley. Even though I'm sore from the climb and aching from the conversation, my pace quickens as I enter the premier's palace. I pass Montfort's soldiers and officers, as well as politicians from his government, marked by their fine suits, all milling around the lower level of the building, leaving meetings or going to them. They watch me pass with scrutiny, but not fear. I'm not a freak here. Two heads of shocking hair, one blue, one bone white, stand out in the crowd of dark green suits and uniforms, Ella and Titan. My fellow electrocons idle in one of the windowed alcoves, taking up enough space that they can be left alone. Waiting for me? You shouldn't have, I say with a smile, my breath still uneven and ragged from the climb. Titan looks me up and down, a lock of white hair falling into his face. He leans back calmly, one long leg planted against the seat across from him. You shouldn't climb mountains alone, he says, especially when you're not good at it. You should spend more time with my brothers, Titan, I reply with little bite. They're better at teasing me than you are. His grin comes easily, but it doesn't reach his dark eyes. Ella huffs at him. Everyone's in Davidson's library, General Farley and the rest. She offers, gesturing down the hall. My stomach swoops at the prospect of facing yet another council. I grip my teeth. How do I look? The woman licks her lips, her eyes running over me. Titan is less diplomatic. Her hesitation should be answer enough, but you don't exactly have time to put on your war paint, Barrow. Right, great, I grumble, leaving them both behind. Quickly, I smooth my hair back, trying to hide the wind-tangled knots with a hasty braid. The rest. Who else could be with Farley and the Premier? The library isn't difficult to find. It's one floor up, occupying a large expanse of the eastern side of the palace. Guards flank the double doors, but they don't stop me as I approach, letting me pass in silence. Like the rest of the compound, the library is bright and cheerful, wood-paneled in lacquered, gleaming oak. The chamber is lined with double rows of shelving, the second story ringed by a narrow landing railed in bronze. Currently, soldiers of the Scarlet Guard perch there, blazing in their red uniforms, guns hanging bare. They note me as I enter, tense but ready to protect their charges should I pose a threat. The Red Generals of Command. Farley sits with them in the center of the room, on green leather couches arranged in a half circle. Ada is with them too, having returned after long weeks with command. She stands to the side, with her arms crossed, silent, observing everything. She offers me a shadow of a smile as I approach. The Scarlet Guard faces a corresponding arrangement of chairs, all occupied by Montfort officers and politicians, with Davidson himself in the center. They murmur in low voices, undisturbed by my presence, or perhaps expecting it. Again, I feel too dirty to be here, stinking of the cold in the mountain. But I really shouldn't worry. The command generals are as disheveled as I feel, if not more so. They just arrived from wherever their roving headquarters were. They look like Farley. Not in appearance, but in attitude. If Farley had 30 or more years under her belt, a lifetime of hard-lived and hard-won survival, the three men and three women are all gray-haired, with short haircuts like Farley's own. I wonder if she wanted to imitate them. Because, despite their similarities, Farley sits in harsh contrast to them all. She is still young, still blooming. Their firebrand. Her father stands among the many officers lining the landing above, leaning against the railing, hands knit together. If he's jealous of his daughter in her position, he doesn't show it. He glances at me as I enter, and even dips his head in greeting, his red eye glowering. The low conversation continues as I move closer. Farley shifts a little, making room for me next to her. But I'm not a general. I'm not command. I haven't earned the right to sit. I fall in behind her, close as a guardian, and cross my arms over my chest.
"Good to meet you, Miss Barrow,"
a curly-haired general says, turning to look at me over her shoulder with the stern eye of a teacher, as if I've just disturbed a particularly important lesson. I nod in return, not wanting to interrupt the meeting any further, though the subject matter does not seem dire. Many advisors talk among themselves, and conversation buzzes among the soldiers above.
"We've only just finished introductions," Ada offers kindly, sidling up next to me.
Farley watches with a glint in her eye. She leans, whispering in my direction. "Don't mind Swan," she adds, nudging the female general. "She's just giving you a hard time." To my surprise, the older woman smirks a little. They have a familiar way about them, like old friends or even family, but they share very little resemblance. Swan is short and slim, with sandy skin dusted in dark freckles. They give her an almost childish look, despite her lines of age. "General Swan," I murmur, ducking my head again in an attempt to be polite. She returns in kind, smiling this time. Under her breath, Ada rattles off the other generals seated on the remaining couches. After her time at their headquarters, she knows them well. The remaining women are Horizon and Sentry, and the men are Drummer, Crimson, and Southern. Codenames, clearly. Still in use, even here.
"General Pallas is still in Norta, keeping our operations moving," Ada says. "She'll relay whatever we can dig up, in Norta and on the borders."
"What about the Lakelands?" I ask. "Iris is going to invade and we'll need to know when." "A few weeks," John said. Not nearly specific enough. Swan clears her throat.
"The Lakelanders closed the borders. I wasn't sure I would be able to get myself out, let alone my staff, and we went as quickly as we could."
Her eyes darken. "Took some doing, if you catch my meaning." Grimly, I nod, and try not to think about how many dead friends she left behind. My eyes skitter across the assembled soldiers and politicians, almost all of them red. A few Silvers of Montfort sit with Davidson, but they are greatly outnumbered. I recognize Radis, the blonde representative from the gallery, among them. He nods his head in the smallest acknowledgement. Davidson does the same, meeting my gaze. With a flush, I clear my throat loudly, stepping out a little. Only the nearby generals turn to look at me. Their soldiers are more difficult to silence, and I have to try again with more force. Slowly but surely, quiet ripples through them, until every eye in the library lands on me. I swallow hard against the familiar but still unsettling sensation. Don't flinch, don't blush, don't hesitate. "My name is Mare Barrow," I say to the assembled crowd. Someone on the landing scoffs quietly. I suppose I need no introduction at this point. "Thank you for coming here." I push on, searching for the right way to say what I have to. A man who can see the entire future, passed along some tips, just doesn't sound right. "I'm sorry I'm late, but I was climbing, and I met a man on the mountain."
"Is that a metaphor?" General Crimson mutters gruffly, only to be hushed by the aptly named Drummer, a fantastically round man.
I glance at Ada, then down at Farley. "John," I explain, and her eyes widen. The shock on her face speaks volumes to the room. "He's a new blood seer,
and we've dealt with him before. Davidson raises his chin.
So has Maven. If I'm not mistaken, that man was instrumental in your capture.
Yes, I mutter, almost ashamed. The Premier purses his lips.
And he served Maven for a time.
I nod again. He did, for his own reasons. Even though several of his compatriots look dismissive, Davidson leans forward on his elbows, fixing me with his intense, unreadable gaze.
What did he say, Mayor?
That we can't let the Norton capital fall to the Lakelands, I reply. If we do, the road will be long and bloody, worse than anything before. If they win Archeon, the Lakelands will control Norda for 100 years. Radis huffs, inspecting his polished nails. He isn't the only one to roll their eyes at such a statement.
I don't need a seer to know that, he mutters.
A few of the generals bob their heads in agreement. Swan speaks for them.
We know an invasion is coming. It's just a matter of when.
A few weeks. I can already feel the clock ticking against us. That's what John told me. Swan narrows her eyes, not with unkindness or suspicion, but with pity.
And you believe him? After all he did to you?
Images flash in my head, memories of my captivity, the prison John bought me, with whatever scheme of fate he put in motion. I told him before that I didn't like being his pawn, and it's exactly what I'm doing now. Somehow, I think I do, I reply, fighting to keep my voice firm. The words set off another round of murmurs and even a bit of shouting, from the generals, the representatives, even the soldiers above us. Only 3 of us remain silent, trading glances. Farley, Davidson, and myself. As I look between them, jumping from golden eyes to blue, I see the same resolve in both of them and feel it in myself. We'll fight again. We just need to figure out how. As usual, Farley jumps in first. She stands up, hands outstretched, motioning for quiet. It works a little, silencing her soldiers as well as the generals. Some of the Montfort diplomats still whisper among themselves. We need a plan, she barks.
Regardless of what the seer says, we all know this road leads to Archeon. Montfort and the Scarlet Guard have to be able to overthrow the Norton capital if we want any chance of freeing the country, no matter who sits on the throne.
Swan nods. I was stationed in the Lakelands before we fled here. I've seen more of their strength than anyone here. If the Signet Queens gain the city before we can, it will be almost impossible to take it back. It's in our best interest to fight the weaker enemy.
Cal. Never have I thought of him as the weaker half of anything. But it's certainly true. His position is precarious at best. I try not to picture him alone in his palace, trying to balance the world his father and brother broke.
You still have Scarlet Guard in Archeon, yes?
Davidson asks, and his voice is enough to quiet the rest of his people. Palace is stationed just outside, Farley says. With her own team still in place through as much of the country as can be managed, Harbor Bay, Delphi, the Archeon outskirts. Drummer, the portly general, jumps in.
Palace has orders to move into the city. Quietly, of course. The new king is not his brother, and his regime is not yet openly hostile to the Scarlet Guard. We can risk it. So we'll have eyes in the city, at least, Davidson muses. Yours as well as our own. We'll make sure they coordinate. The Scarlet Guard has infiltrated Archeon before.
Drummer puffs out his impressive chest.
It can be done again.
The Premier's lips press into a thin, grim line.
But not in the same way, he says. Too dangerous from the air, now that Cal has the full force of the air fleet behind him. We can't match their aerial strength for a landing, and we can't rely on surprise like we did at Maven's wedding.
And the tunnels, Farley mutters,
thinking of a coup that failed before it even began. King Maven closed up everything beneath the city. Not everything, I blurt out. The others blink at me, hard-eyed and eager. I've seen Maven's train, his escape plan. It runs straight under the treasury, and there are more entrances below the palace. He used it to leave the city unseen. I'm willing to bet he left some tunnels intact, if only for his own use. With a will, Drummer rolls to his feet. He's surprisingly agile for his age and size.
I can relay to Palace. Have her start sniffing it out. Ada, you've got city plans in your head, yes?
I do, sir. She answers quickly. I can't imagine what Ada doesn't have preserved in her perfect mind.
Drummer ducks his chin.
Get on the comms with Palace. Help her run her operatives.
Without hesitation, Ada nods.
Yes, sir, she says, already walking from the library.
Farley clenches her jaw and watches our friend go, disappearing from the room. Then she glances sidelong at me, weighing my response.
Do we have time for that?
Probably not, I mutter. If only John had been more precise in his damned warning. But I suppose that's too easy. It isn't his way.
So what can we do?
She prods. A sudden headache throbs at my temples, and I pinch the bridge of my nose. Earlier today, I climbed a mountain to keep away from Maven. Of course, my efforts only prolonged the inevitable, and the necessary. Well, I guess we can just ask. Without Julian to sing a confession out of him, or any whispers, new blood or otherwise, an interrogation of Maven Kalor will be a two-sided battle of wills and deception. Though Montfort has silvers to spare, none can draw truth through ability alone. But they can draw it through pain. Before Maven is brought in, one of the officers returns with Titan in tow, the white-haired electricon looking dour as he enters the room. He settles into his seat on Davidson's side of the room and drums his fingers, the movement quick and twitching, like the lightning he may have to use on Maven. His ability is far more precise than my own, able to push a body to its limit without destroying what cannot be repaired. The room is deathly silent, empty of the soldiers above, as well as most of the Montfort representatives. Davidson and the guard generals are smart enough not to give Maven an audience. He's too good a performer, too good a liar. I can sit now, sandwiched between Farley and the armrest of her couch. She's broader than I am, but I'm glad for her close presence. The thought of Maven still chills my blood. At least in Archaon there was Cal to split his attention, his obsession, and his fury. Now, there's just me. His guards are many, a half dozen at least. Montfort soldiers and Scarlet Guard alike, armed to the teeth with weapons and abilities. He revels in the attention and the need for such precautions, smiling slightly as they lead him into the library. His icy eyes sweep over the chamber quickly, noting the windows, the books, and the people waiting for him. I hold his gaze.
I must admit, I never expected to see you again, Premier,
he says, breaking his stare to look at Davidson. The unflappable man doesn't react, his face still and neutral.
Nor did I ever think I would set foot in the mysterious wilds of Montfort.
But this isn't so wild, is it?
Not as much as you would have us believe.
It's wild enough, I think, remembering our battle with a herd of bison.
I was taught your country was a land of silvers as much as my own, albeit divided by many kings and lords. How wrong my instructors were.
Maven keeps on, turning slightly as he speaks. He could be counting us, the seven generals of command, matched by Davidson and the representatives from his government and military. He stops when he spots Radis, plainly silver-blooded with his cold-hued skin.
How interesting, he murmurs. I don't believe we've had the pleasure, sir.
The older silver flexes a hand, the waning sunlight flashing on his long nails, a soft brush of wind
rustles through Maven's hair. A warning.
Save your breath, princeling. There are things to discuss.
Maven only grins.
I just didn't expect to see Silvers here, in the midst of such
crimson company.
I huff, already bored with his stalling tactics.
You said yourself you don't know anything about this place.
Maven turns back to me, glaring, but I wave him off.
And you don't need to.
He bares his teeth.
Because you'll execute me before long? Is that the threat you're trying to make, Mare?
I set my jaw, electing not to answer.
It's an empty one. If you were going to kill me, you would have done it already. I'm worth more alive, to you and your cause.
The room remains silent in reply.
Oh, don't play coy,
Maven sneers. As long as I breathe, I'm a threat to my brother, same as he was to me. I assume he's collecting loyalties now, recalling the High Houses of Norta, trying to win over those who pledged allegiance to me, and some will, but
all? Slowly, he ticks his head back and forth, clucking his tongue like a scolding mother.
No, they'll sit back and wait, or they'll fight him.
For you, I snap back. I doubt that.
He makes a noise, low in his throat, a growl more suited to an animal.
What exactly do you need from me?
He says, wrenching his eyes away. He moves gracefully, swiveling on his toes to face the rest of the chamber. The fallen king has no cage, but he is obviously trapped. For some reason, his eyes waver on Titan, looking over the Electricon with his white hair and calmly murderous disposition.
And who is he?
To my surprise, I hear fear in Maven Kalor. Farley pounces, smelling blood in the water.
You're going to tell us what you did to the Archeon tunnels. Which ones are closed, which ones are open, which ones you built after you took the throne.
In spite of his predicament, Maven rolls his eyes and laughs.
You people and your tunnels.
The young general is not deterred.
Well?
And what do I get out of this? He leers at her.
A better view from my cell?
Not that it would be difficult. I currently have no windows.
With oddly twitching hands, he counts off on his fingers.
Better food?
Visitors, perhaps.
Maven wavers a little, teeth on edge. His body seems to shiver. Whatever control he maintains is beginning to slip.
A painless death?
I fight the urge to grab him, if only to keep him still. He reminds me of a rat in a trap, squirming for his life.
You get the satisfaction, Maven,
I force out. I should be used to the sensation of his eyes running through me. I'm not, and I shudder, his gaze a featherweight on my skin.
Of what? He murmurs.
Despite the yards between us, Maven feels much too close. The words taste sour in my mouth.
You know what?
His grin widens, a white knife to taunt us.
If I can't have the throne, neither can he,
he says plainly.
Well, that's something at least.
His voice drops, as does his grin.
But not enough.
Behind him, Davidson looks to his side, exchanging a stern glance with Titan. After a long moment, the white-haired Electricon unfolds from his chair. He rises slowly, deliberately, hands loose at each side. Maven turns at the sound, sharp in his motions, his eyes widen.
Who is he?
Maven asks again. I try to ignore the tremor in his voice. I raise my chin.
Someone like me.
Titan drums a hand against his leg, running a single blinding white spark down his finger. But stronger. Dark lashes flutter against pale cheeks, and Maven's throat bobs. His next words are reluctant, stumbling, low, almost inaudible.
I need something in exchange, he hisses. My teeth clench in frustration. Maven, I already told you. The fallen king cuts me off, wrenching his eyes from Titan to look back at me with all his black fire. When you invade, which you're planning to do, he sneers, baring his teeth, I'll lead you where you need to go. Which tunnels, which paths. I'll bring your whole army into the city myself and set you loose on my wretched brother. Farley scoffs from her seat. Into a trap, no doubt. Into the teeth of your Signet bride. Oh, she'll be there, no doubt, Maven replies, waving a finger at her. Her face flushes with anger. That snake and her mother have been planning to take Norta since the moment she set foot in my kingdom. The moment you let her in. I mutter. Maven barely flinches. A calculated risk. And so is this. Hardly convincing, even to those who don't know him. The command generals look more disgusted than when he walked in. No mean feat. While the new bloods of Montfort seem more inclined to skin Maven alive. The premier, usually so level-headed, curls his lips into the rare, obvious scowl. Again, he nods to Titan, and the Electricon takes one shuddering step forward. It sets something off in Maven. He jumps out of reach, keeping his distance from all of us. The twitching returns in force, but his eyes blaze, all fire, no fear. You think I can't lie through pain? He snarls, his voice thundering through the room. You think I haven't done it 1,000 times? No one has an answer for him, especially not me. I try not to react, not to give him the satisfaction of seeing an emotion from me. I fail horribly, unable to keep my eyes open. For a brief, empty moment, I see nothing but darkness, and I try not to think of Maven. His words, what his life was, and continues to be, and how we've all suffered because of it. I expect the others to give him no quarter, to torture what we need from him, draw it out with lightning and pain. Will I be strong enough to watch? Even Farley falters. She stares at Maven, trying to read him, to weigh the risk and the cost. He meets her eyes without quailing. She swears under her breath. For once, he's telling the truth. Maven Kalor is our only chance.
30. Cal. A coronation has always been in my future. The ceremonial crown is not a surprise. I turn it over in my hands, feeling the formidable weight of iron, silver, and gold. In less than an hour, my grandmother will put the monstrosity on my head. My father wore it too. He was already a king when I was born, with a different queen from the only one I recall. I wish I could remember her. I wish the memories I had of my mother were my own, and not stories from Julian. Not the brush of oil paint instead of living flesh. The diary copy is still locked away, hidden in a drawer at my bedside in my Archeon chambers. I'll have to move it soon, once the king's rooms are prepared, washed clean of Maven's presence. I shudder at the thought. I don't know why I'm so hesitant to lay hands on such a small and terrible thing. It's just a book. Just a jumble of scrawled letters pieced together. I face down execution squads and armies, fought lightning and storm, dodged bullets, fallen through the sky more than once. And somehow, my mother's diary scares me more than anything else. I could barely get through a few pages, and even those I had to read with my flame maker bracelet far away. Her words set me so on edge, I didn't want to risk turning the pages to ash in my hands. The last pieces of Corianne Jacos, carefully preserved by my uncle. The original is long gone, but he was able to save this much of her. I don't know what her voice sounded like. I could find out, if I really wanted to. There are many recordings of her, and photographs too. but like my father did, I stay away from them. From a ghost I never knew. Part of me doesn't want to get up from the table here in this room. It's quiet, peaceful, the inside of a bubble about to burst. I feel as if I'm standing on a threshold. The windows look out on Caesar's Square, offering a full view of the chaos to come. Silvers in their house colors stream back and forth over the plaza, most of them heading for the royal court. I can barely look at the structure, one of many ringing the square. My father was crowned there, beneath a glittering dome, and Maven was married in the court some months ago. Mare was with him then. She won't be here now. The loss of her still hurts. A deep wound, but it's missing the same edge as before. We both knew what we were doing, what our choices would be when the time came to choose. I only wish we'd had a few more days, a few more hours. Now she's gone. With Maven again. I should be angry. It's a betrayal by any other name. She stole a valuable prisoner from me. His execution would have been an easy and almost bloodless way to reunite my kingdom. But somehow, I can't feel anything but annoyance. Partly because I'm not surprised. And mostly because Maven is far beyond my reach. He's her problem now. At least I won't have to be the one to kill him. It's the thought of a coward. Something I was never allowed to be. I think it anyway. I hope he dies without pain. The knock at the door gets me up faster than I want, my legs unfolding beneath me. I wrench it open before Julian or Nanabel steps inside, hoping to do just one last thing on my own. I'm not a fool. I know what they are to me, besides my last remaining family. Advisors. Mentors. Rivals to each other. I only hope they haven't come together to poison my peace with their competition. It's just Julian waiting, to my relief. He offers a twitch of a smile and spreads his arms wide, showing off his new clothing, specially made for the coronation. His colors dominate, the dusty yellow gold of House Jacos forming the base of his trim jacket and pants, but his lapels are blood red, my own color, displaying his allegiance not just to House Kalor, but to me. It forces me to think of what he's done in my name. Traded a man's life for my brother, and maybe another life too. I haven't forgotten. His scheming, as well as my grandmother's, is never far from my mind. It makes me wary. Even of him. Is this what being king is? Trusting no one? I force a laugh to disguise my unease. You look good, I tell him. It isn't like Julian to be so put together, nearly handsome in his lean form. My uncle steps inside. This old thing? He offers with a dry smile. What about you? Are you ready? I gesture to my own clothes. The now familiar blood-red suit, edged in black, with silver adornments and enough medals to sink a Lakelander ship. I haven't donned the matching cape yet. It's too heavy, and kind of stupid-looking. I'm not talking about the clothes, Cal, Julian says. My cheeks flush. I turn quickly, trying to hide any sign of weakness or trepidation. I figured you weren't. Well? He asks, taking a step closer. I do as I've always been taught. I hold my ground. Father told me once there's no such thing as being ready. If you think you are, you aren't. Then I guess it's a good thing you look like you might escape out a window. Comforting. Your father was nervous too, Julian says softly. Tentative, he puts a hand on my shoulder. His touch, a soft weight. My tongue sticks in my mouth. unable to form the words I want to say. But Julian is smart enough to know what I want to ask. Your mother told me, my uncle explains. She said he'd wished he had more time. More time. I feel like Julian just hit me in the chest with a hammer. Don't we all? He shrugs in his usual frustrating way, like he knows more than I do, which I suspect he does. For different reasons, I think, he says. Strange, isn't it? No matter how different we might be, we all end up wanting the same thing. I avoid his eyes when they rise to mine. They look far too much like the eyes in my mother's painting. But for all the wanting, all the hoping, all the dreaming we might do, all I can do is nod, cutting him off. I don't have the luxury of that anymore. Dreaming? He blinks, perplexed, but also intrigued. My Uncle Julian delights in puzzles, and he looks on me as one. You're about to be a king, Cal. You could dream with your eyes open and build what you wish. Again, I feel the hammer blow. My chest aches with the force of his words, as well as the judgment behind them. And of course, because I've heard that same damned sentiment so many times. I'm tired of telling people that isn't true. Julian narrows his eyes and I cross my arms instinctively, shielding myself. Are you sure? He asks. If you're talking about Mare, she's already halfway across the continent, and she won't... Almost smiling, Julian holds up a hand, showing long, thin fingers. Soft hands, better suited to book pages. Never used in war. Never needed in battle. I envy those hands. Cal, I'm a romantic, but I'm sorry to say I'm not talking about her or your broken heart. That is incredibly low on my list of worries. You have my sympathy, but there are many, many other things to be considered right now. Again, heat flares on my cheeks and even the tops of my ears. Julian takes it in stride and, thankfully, looks away. When you're ready to go, I'll be outside the door. But time is up. I can't hide any longer. Like Father said, I murmur. With a will, I sling the cape around my shoulders, fastening it in place. I'll never be ready. I walk around him and pull open the door. Stepping out of the protection of my private chambers feels like running a mile. Sweat prickles down my back, rolling along my spine. With every fiber, I fight the urge to run away, to go back, to stand still. Julian keeps pace at my side, like a crutch. Chin up, he warns. Your grandmother is around the corner. I shoot him the best grin I can muster. It feels weak and false. Like so many things these days. The crystal dome of the royal court is a masterwork of silver craftsmanship. As a boy, I thought it was made of stars stolen from the night sky, each one molded to glittering perfection. It still gleams today, but not as brightly as it should. Red servants are few, many having elected to leave their posts rather than accept better pay and treatment. They aren't around to make the capital gleam and shine the way it should for a coronation. I can't even look the part, I think bitterly. My reign begins in ashes. Such is the way across the capital, and across my new kingdom. Reds pursuing a new place in the world, and silvers scrambling to understand what it means for the rest of us. The tech towns are almost empty, and rolling power outages plague many cities, Archaon included. Our manufacturing capabilities will follow quickly, with stores and supplies already strained. I can barely fathom the effect this will have on our war effort, and our military might. I expected this, of course. I knew this would happen. At least the Lakelander War is over. Or, I should say, the first Lakelander War. Another is certainly about to start. It's only a matter of time before Iris and her mother return, their armies in tow. Murmurs follow me down the long aisle of the court until I reach the center of the floor beneath the dome. The massive hall echoes as if filled with hissing ghosts, all sneering about my failure, my betrayal, my weakness. I try not to think about such things as I kneel before the eyes of dozens, my neck bare and vulnerable. We attacked Maven after a ceremony in this very place. Who's to say someone else wouldn't repay the favor? Try not to think about that either. I focus instead on the floor beneath my knees, bone-white marble swirled with charcoal gray. The absence of color in the room is supposed to look striking next to a crowd of the multicolored high houses, white and black against the rainbow. The court seats 1,000 comfortably, but less than 100 are here today. Many houses were decimated by the Civil War, lost in battle on both sides, for both sons of House Kalor. My grandmother's house stands out proudly in their flaming colors, as do the surviving members of Evangeline's family, Samos and Viper both. Allies like House Laris and Iral are easy to pick out. There are others too, families who were loyal to Maven before, but no longer. Rhombos, well, Macanthos, sit in their colors. Red, brown, green and gold, silvery blue. But others are missing entirely. The Osanos nymphs are nowhere to be seen. The same can be said of Igri, Provos, and, to my chagrin, many Skonos skin healers and every Arvin silent. They aren't the only ones. I'm sure Julian and Nanabel are taking stock of who refused to come, carefully noting who is an ally and who is still an enemy. Not enough of one, too many of the other. Above me, Nanabel is careful not to look bothered by the obvious absences in the court. Her face is still and proud, her bronze eyes nearly aflame as she holds my father's crown.
"Long live the true king, Tiberius the Seventh," she says firmly, her voice echoing around the chamber. Even though the circle of iron is cold on my brow, I don't startle or flinch. I'm trained not to bat an eye at gunshots or flame. But when the silver nobles around me repeat her words, I start to shiver. They say it again and again. The true king. It resounds like a heartbeat. It's real. This is happening. I am a king. The king. Finally, I'm where I was born to be. On the one hand, I feel the same as I did this morning. I'm still Cal, still plagued by aches old and new, bruises seen and unseen, still terrified of what is to come and what I might have to do in order to protect my weak kingdom, terrified of who this crown will turn me into. Has the transformation already begun? Perhaps. In small parts of me, forgotten corners, I may be changing. I already feel apart, alone. Even with Julian and my grandmother looming close, my own flesh and blood. But too many people are missing. My mother, my father, Mare, and Maven, too. The brother I thought I had, the person who barely existed, never existed. We grew up knowing I would be king and he would stand at my side. My strongest ally, my most fervent supporter, my best advisor, a shield and a crutch. A second opinion, a sanctuary. Not once did I question the arrangement, and I never thought he did either.
how wrong I was. The loss of him hurt before, but now, with a crown on my head, with no one to take his place, suddenly, it's very difficult to breathe. I have to look at Nanabel, to hopefully find whatever solace I can in my grandmother. She smiles just for me, bracing her hands on my shoulders. I try to see my father in her, a flawed king, a flawed parent. And I miss him terribly, especially right now. I would hug her if she'd let me, but she keeps me at a distance, her elbows locked, forcing me to stand up straight, on display, on parade, a vision for the nobles, a message. Tiberius Calor is king, and he will never kneel again. Not even to Volo Samos. We approach him first, Nanabel on my arm, one king to another. I bow my head, and so does Volo. He looks me over slowly, his expression stony but vague.
Congratulations, Your Majesty, he says, eyeing my crown.
I do the same, nodding at the naked steel across his forehead. Thank you, Your Majesty. At his side, the Viper Queen stiffens, one hand firm on her husband's arm, as if to hold him back. But Volo does nothing, and neither do I. My grandmother and I manage to pass without incident, nodding in turn to the Samos royals. Evangeline catches my eye, looking small at her brother's side. She's more subdued than usual, her gown and jewelry dull in comparison to the rest of her family. Silver silk, so dark it might be black, better suited to attending a funeral instead of a coronation. After what she said a week ago, she very well could be. If her suspicions are correct, her father is living on borrowed time, and she won't raise a finger to stop it. The moment shudders between us, born of a mutual secret and an understanding that neither of us wants what comes next. Now that I'm officially the King of Norta, there's nothing standing in the way of my marriage to Evangeline. It's been a long time coming, and yet somehow, nowhere near long enough. We have no more illusions where this betrothal is concerned. Evangeline's face falls, melting from detached apathy to disgust. She turns away, using the bulk of her brother's body to hide her face. The next few hours blur together in a swirl of color and pleasantries. I'm no stranger to royal celebrations. It's easy to slip back into the rhythm, playing an easy game of conversation, saying much and still saying nothing at all. Nanabel and Julian stay with me through it, and we make a formidable team. If only the two of them weren't so obvious at their game. With Maven defeated and a war momentarily ended, their alliance is shaky at best. There's nothing to unite them besides me, and I feel like little more than a bone tugged between two hounds. My grandmother is more vicious, more daring, a queen of many years who knows how to navigate both a court and a battlefield. But Julian knows my heart better than she does. I do my best to enjoy the food at dinner. It's edible, but nothing compared to the feasts we used to have. Somehow I find myself missing Carmadon and Premier Davidson's dinner. While this is infinitely less awkward, what they prepared was delicious. I'm not the only one who notices the quality. Evangeline doesn't touch a single course, and her mother doesn't even condescend to feed her meat to the panther curled around her ankles. Like the electricity, like the servants, like the factories grinding to a halt all over Norta, good food seems to be growing scarce. In the fields, the deliveries, the preparation. I'd wager most of the palace chefs are gone too. Nanabel cleans her plate like nothing is amiss. We're going to lose this war. I can't help but murmur,
leaning to my left so only Julian can hear me. A muscle flexes in his cheek, and he drains his glass of wine.
"Not here, Cal,"
he replies, hiding his mouth with the rim of his glass.
"Would the king like to retire?"
"The king would."
"Very well,"
my uncle mutters, putting his glass back down. For a second, I don't know what to do. I realize I'm waiting to be dismissed, but no one here can do such a thing. This is my throne and my palace. I need only stand. I do so quickly, clearing my throat to excuse myself. Nanabel is quick to recognize the signal. I need to be done with this.
"Our thanks for your presence today and your loyalty,"
she says, her hands spread wide to better command the attention of the chamber. The nobles in front of us fall silent, their murmurs and conversations sliding to a graceful halt.
"We have all journeyed through the storm, as it were, and I speak for the royal family when I say how grateful we are to have you with us, and to have Norta made whole again."
It's a naked lie, plain as the food forgotten on so many plates. Norta is far from whole. The half-empty banquet hall is proof of that. And while I don't want to be a king like Maven, building my throne on deceit and dishonesty, I see no other option now. We need to be strong, even if it is only an illusion. I put a hand to Nanabel's shoulder, a careful gesture. She obliges, angling back to let me speak. "One storm has passed, yes. But I would be a fool to pretend another is not gathering on the horizon," I say, speaking as clearly as I can. So many eyes look back at me. Their clothes and colors vary, but not their blood. Everyone seated here is silver, and I shudder at the implication. Our red allies are gone for good. When war comes again, we will be fighting alone. "The Lakelands will not be satisfied behind their borders. Not when they came so close to ruling Maven through their princess." Some of the nobles murmur, their heads drawn together. Volo doesn't move, staring at me from his seat farther down the high table. I feel pierced by his glare. "When the storm breaks, I'll be ready. I promise you that." Ready to fight, to lose, and probably die. "Strength and power!" someone shouts from the crowd, cheering the old refrain of my father and his father before him. An emblem of silver Norta. Others echo the call. I should, too. But I can't. I know what those words mean. Who exactly we have strength and power over. My jaw remains firmly shut. Julian stays close on my heels as I escape the banquet hall, utilizing the serving passages instead of the main halls. My grandmother trails us, with her Lareland soldiers bringing up the rear of our patchwork parade. I still don't have sentinels, as a king should, as I did when I was a prince and things still worked properly. We're rightfully wary of the guards once oathed to protect Maven, even if many of them have pledged their loyalty with their houses. Finding guards of my own, people I can trust, is simply another item on an increasingly long list of things to be accomplished. Just the thought exhausts me. I'm yawning by the time I reach the door to my temporary quarters, even though it's barely past nightfall. At least I have a good excuse to be tired. It isn't every day one becomes king. The crown is an infinite reminder. Both Nanabel and Julian follow me into the adjoining salon, leaving the guards in the hall. I stop my grandmother with a look. "If it's all right, I'd like to speak to Julian." I try to make it sound like an order. I shouldn't be asking permission to talk with one of my closest advisors alone. Still, I feel tentative and sound worse.
Her face falls, pulling into an affronted frown. Wounded, even. Like I've hurt her. Briefly, I add, trying to undo the harm. Next to her, Julian clasps his hands together, his expression blank. She stiffens.
Of course, Your Majesty,
she murmurs, ducking her head. Her iron-gray hair reflects the lamps like a flash of steel.
I'll leave you to it.
With a rushing whirl of flame-colored clothing, my grandmother turns on her heel without another word. My fist clenches, keeping me from reaching out. It's difficult balancing the love of family with the needs of a kingdom. The door shuts behind her, sharper than it needs to. I wince with the sound. Julian wastes no time, opening his mouth before he manages to take a seat on the plump sofa. I brace myself for the inevitable lecture.
You shouldn't speak that way in public, Cal.
We're going to lose this war. He isn't wrong. I grimace anyway, crossing to the arched windows overlooking the bridge of Archeon, the river, and the star-dappled horizon beyond. From this distance, the ships on the water look like stars, too. As with the crowd at the coronation, there are fewer ships than there should be. Less trade, less travel. I've been king for a day and my kingdom is already living on borrowed time. I can only guess what might happen to the people in it, should the rest collapse. I lay a hand against the window glass. It steams beneath my touch. We don't have the manpower to turn back an invasion. Your decree puts our armies at 40% strength, if the current reports are accurate. Most Red soldiers have left the military or are leaving. New recruits, mostly. Those left behind are battle-hardened, at least, he says. But spread too thin, I mutter. The Lakelander border is hostile again, not to mention Piedmont to the south. We're surrounded and outnumbered. And with fall coming, what harvest can we expect with no farmers? How can we shoot the guns if no one is making the bullets? My uncle brushes a hand under his chin, studying me. You regret making your decrees? He is one of only two people I would ever admit it to. I do. It was the right decision. For how long? I can't help but snap. Flaring with heat, I turn away from the window, undoing the top buttons of my jacket as I move. The colder air hits my fevered skin, chilling and soothing. When the Lakelands return, they'll wipe away whatever I've tried to do. This is the way of things, Cal. Julian's calm tone only serves to rankle me further. In the histories, great moments of upheaval, whole shifts in societies, they take time to rebalance. Reds will return to work, albeit with better pay and treatment. They need to feed and protect their families, too. We don't have that kind of time, Julian, I mutter, exasperated. I think someone will have to redraw your maps very soon. The Kingdom of Norta will fall. He tracks me as I pace, never moving from his seat. I suppose I should have asked this days ago, but is there a reason you're so married to the idea of this kingdom and that crown? Instead of spinning out, my mind slows. My tongue feels heavy in my mouth, a stone weighing down whatever I might struggle to say. Julian continues on through my silence. You say now that you think we'll lose. You'll lose, because of the decrees and changes you've chosen to make, because you have no allies. On the sofa he stretches, gesturing with one hand. He casts his fingers toward the window, meaning all things. You did almost everything the Scarlet Guard and Montfort asked. Gave up everything they wanted, except that. He points at the crown still nestled on my head. Why? If you knew you would never be able to keep it. My answer sounds foolish, like it comes from a child. I say it anyway. This is my father's crown.
But the crown is not your father,
he says quickly, rising to his feet. In two strides, he has me by the shoulder, and his voice softens. It isn't your mother either, and it won't bring either of them back. I can't bear to look at him. He is too much like her, like the shadow of my mother I carry in my head. A wish and a dream, probably, not a real reflection of her. An impossibility. Maven was tortured by his mother who lived and breathed, but I am tortured too. Tortured by a woman taken away from me. This is who I am, Julian. I try to keep my breathing even, try to sound like a king. The words make sense as I think them, but they come out wrong. Stumbling, unsure. It's everything I've ever known. The only path I've ever wanted or been made to want. My uncle tightens his grip on my shoulders. Your brother could say the same, and where did that lead him? I bristle at that, glaring at him. We're not the same. No, you aren't, he replies hastily. Then his attitude changes, a strange look coming over him. Julian narrows his eyes, lips pressing into a thin, grim line. You haven't read the diary, have you? Again, I drop my gaze, ashamed of how afraid I am of a simple, small book. I don't think I can, I whisper, barely audible. Julian offers no quarter, no comfort. He stands back, crossing his arms. He doesn't need many words to scold me. Well, you need to, he says simply, taking on the air of a teacher again. Not just for yourself, but for the rest of us. All of us. I don't see how the diary of a dead woman can be any help right now. Well, hopefully you summon the courage to find out. Reading it feels like pushing a stone through mud. Sluggish, difficult, foolish. The words pull at me with inky fingers, trying to hold me back. Each page is heavier than the last. Until they aren't. Until the stone is rolling down a hill, and the voice I give my mother rings in my head, speaking as quickly as my mind allows. Sometimes my eyes blur. I don't stop to wipe the tears from the pages, letting them mark the hours as the night passes. Sometimes I find myself smiling. My mother liked to tinker with things. Repair and build. Just like me. Sometimes I even laugh. The way she talks about Julian, their kind rivalry, how he gave her books she would never read. I can almost trick myself into thinking she's alive. Sitting next to me instead of trapped in a book. But mostly I feel a deep ache. Hunger for her. Sorrow. Regret. My mother had her demons. Just like the rest of us. Her own pains that began long before she became a queen. Before my father married her and put a target on her back. Her entries grow scarcer as time wears on. As her life changes. There are only a few pages dedicated to me.
He will not be a soldier. I owe him that much. Too long the sons and daughters of House Kalor have been fighting. Too long has this country had a warrior king. Too long have we been at war, on the front and also within. It might be a crime to write such things, but I am a queen. I am the queen. I can say and write what I think. The Kalors are children of fire, as strong and destructive as their flame, but Kal will not be like the others before. Fire can destroy,
Fire can kill, but it can also create. Forest burned in the summer will be green by spring, better and stronger than before. Cal's flame will build and bring roots from the ashes of war. The guns will quiet, the smoke will clear, and the soldiers, red and silver both, will come home. 100 years of war, and my son will bring peace. He will not die fighting. He will not. He will not.
I run a finger over the letters, feeling the press of a faraway pen. This isn't her handwriting, but Julian's. Her real diaries were destroyed by Ilara Mirandis, but Julian had the wherewithal to preserve something before they disappeared. He painstakingly copied each letter. Even these. He nearly put a hole in the page writing those words. They certainly put a hole through me. Corianne Jacos wanted a different life for her son, entirely separate from how I was raised and who my father made me into. I have to wonder if there is some fate in between what each of my parents wanted for me, a path that is truly my own to choose. Or is it simply too late?
31. Maven. I am not even afforded a window. At least I gave Mare one, when she was my prisoner. Of course, that was a torture as much as anything else. Letting her see the world pass, the seasons change, from behind the bars of her opulent cage. I don't think this is quite as personal an affront. Clearly, they will take no chances with me. My flame maker bracelets are long gone, probably destroyed. They're silent stones set in the floor, dulling any ability I have left. I'm watched night and day by no less than 12 guards, each one alert and ready on the other side of cell bars. I'm the only person being held here. No one speaks to me, not even the guards. Only Mother whispers to me still, and those words are ever fleeting, growing dim, leaving me with my thoughts. It's the only benefit of Silent Stone. While it weakens the rest of me, it weakens her voice as well. I felt the same thing on my old throne. It was a shield as much as an anchor, making me ache, but also keeping me insulated from influence, both within and without. Any choice I made in that seat was mine alone. It's the same here. I choose to sleep, mostly. Even the stone won't allow me to dream. It can't undo whatever she did. Mother took that ability away long ago, and it never came back. Sometimes I stare at the walls. They're cool to the touch, and I suspect were partially underground. I was blindfolded when I was led into the city and brought to speak before that strange council. I must spend hours tracing the lines of mortar and cement holding the slabs together, running my fingers over rough and smooth textures. Normally, I'd talk out my thoughts to myself, but the guards are always there, always listening. It would be more than stupid to give them any glimpse, however small, into my mind. Cal is alone, cut off from his strongest allies. He did it to himself, the fool. Iris and her mother won't waste much time, or give him the opportunity to try to stabilize the kingdom. He got that crown he wanted so much, but he won't keep it long. I smile to think of my perfect brother perfectly ruining things for himself. All he had to do was say no, turn aside the throne. He'd have his armies, he'd have a chance, he'd have Mare. But even she wasn't enough for him. I guess I understand that. She wasn't enough for me either. Enough to make me change, to pull me back from what I've willingly become. I wonder if Thomas would have been enough. As usual, this splitting headache comes whenever I think his name, or remember his face, or feel his touch on my hands. I lie back against the cot in the corner, pressing my fists against my eyes, trying to relieve the pressure of the memory and this place. I know less than I should about Montfort, let alone its capital, Ascendant. Even trying to plan an escape from here would be a waste of my time and limited energy. Of course, I'll take my chances in Archeon, lose them in the tunnels after setting another army on my brother. The last revenge of Maven Kalor, before I disappear. To where, I don't know. It's just another waste to try to plan beyond Archeon. I'll cross that bridge when it comes. Certainly Mare will suspect. She knows me well enough by now. I might have to kill her at the end of this. Her life or mine. A difficult choice, but I'll choose myself. I do it every time. We need to know where to enter the tunnels. At first, I wonder if I'm actually dreaming, if that piece of my mother has finally been washed away. But that's impossible. I open my eyes to see Mare standing on the other side of the bars, far enough to be out of reach. The guards are gone, or at least out of sight, probably gathered at either end of the corridor, ready to be called upon if necessary. It's been 2 days since I was summoned to the Premier's council, and she doesn't look like she's slept since. The Lightning Girl is worn, with shadows beneath her eyes and cheekbones. Still, she looks better than she did when she was my prisoner, in spite of the gowns and jewels I kept her in. Her eyes spark here. She isn't hollowed out, aching to the bone. I know that sensation intimately. I feel it here now. And I felt it when I was a king, shielded by a silent throne. Slowly I rise up on my elbows, peering at her over the toes of my shoes. 2 days to agree to my terms, I say, counting off on my fingers. Must have been quite the argument. Careful, Maven, she barks out the warning, all rough edges. Any difficulty and I'll be happy to call Titan down here. The other new blood who shares her ability is a stranger, with his white hair and inscrutable eyes. Stronger than me, she said back in the council, and I have seen such strength from Mare Barrow. Certainly his lightning will shred me, nerve from nerve. Not that it will help them. I can withstand torture. I know how to keep my mouth shut, even if it means dying. Still, I don't fancy being turned into a light bulb this early in the day. No, I'd rather you didn't, I answer her. I do so enjoy our time alone. Her eyes narrow, dancing over me. Even at a distance, I can hear her sharp intake of breath. I smirk a little, satisfied that I can still draw such a reaction from her, even if her response is firmly rooted in fear. That's something, at least. Better than apathy. Better than nothing at all. I suppose this is the end of that, I continue, swinging my legs out and onto the floor. The metal is cool against my forehead as I lean, bracing myself against the bars. No more whispers between Maven and Mare. She sneers, and I brace myself for the inevitable spray of spit. It never comes. I'm done trying to understand you, she hisses, still out of reach. But she doesn't flinch when I look her over. Doesn't tremble when I raise a hand, stretching out my fingers to brush within an inch of her face. But it isn't me she fears, not really. Her eyes flicker, looking down at the floor of my cell, at the stone set neatly in cement. I laugh, deep in my throat. It echoes off the walls. I really did break something in you, didn't I? Mare recoils like I've struck her. I can almost see the bruise forming on her heart. She grits her teeth, straightening her spine. Nothing that I can't fix, she grinds out. I can feel the smile on my face turn bitter, tainted, corrupted, like the rest of me. If only I could say the same. My words echo, soften, and die. She crosses her arms and looks at her feet. I watch her keenly, trying to commit every piece of her to memory. The tunnels, Maven. You heard my terms, I reply. I go with you. I lead your armies. Her head snaps up. If not for the stone beneath my feet, I might feel the hum of static. That isn't good enough, she says. Time to call her bluff. Then electrocute me. Call your torturer and risk your war on the words bought with my blood. Trust that they're the truth. Are you willing to do that? She throws up her hands, exasperated. Like I'm a child instead of a king. It rankles, sandpaper on my skin. We need a compromise at least. Where the tunnels start. I raise an eyebrow coolly. And where they end? That's your piece of the puzzle to keep. Until we need it. I hum out, tapping a finger to my chin. I even start to pace, putting on a grand show for my rapturous audience. Her eyes track my movements, and I'm reminded of the panther Evangeline's mother keeps so close. I assume you'll be coming along. She barely scoffs. Her mouth curves into a delicious scowl. It isn't like you to ask empty, stupid questions. I just shrug. Whatever keeps you standing here. To that, she has no retort. Whatever words she wants to say die on her lips. If only I could touch them. Feel the skin beneath my fingers, smooth and full and pulsing with hot, red blood. Part of me wonders why she is still so transfixing, even though I know she's my sworn enemy. That I would kill her, and she would kill me. Another mystery of my mind that will never be unraveled. She stands firm, letting me look, never wavering beneath my gaze, letting me see past the mask I helped her make. There is exhaustion, and hope, and sadness, of course. A sorrow for so many things. My brother among them. He broke your heart, didn't he? Mare only exhales, her chest falling. What a fool, I whisper, speaking the familiar thought aloud. It doesn't bother her. She tosses her head, letting brown and gray hair flip over her shoulder, revealing the bare skin beneath. And the brand still clear as day. M for Maven. M for mine. M for monster. M for mare. So did you. A sour taste floods my mouth. I expected her to quail, but I'm the one who has to look away. At least I had a good reason, I mutter. Her laugh is sharp and harsh, a single bark that snaps like a whip crack. He did it for the crown, I hiss. Mare leers at me, but never moves her feet, never gets close enough to touch. And you didn't, Maven? I did it for her, of course. I try to sound detached, matter of fact. The cold, broken, doomed Maven. And what she made me into. You keep blaming your mother. I suppose that's easy. My heart leaps in my chest when her feet slide, moving sideways, not closer, not farther. Now it's her turn to prowl. You think Cal's father didn't make him into something too? You think we all aren't made or unmade by someone else? Even though she's only walking, it feels like a dance. I mirror her movements, stepping with her. She's more graceful than I am. A live thief born of many years and many twists of fate. But we all still have the ability to choose in the end. And you chose to keep the blood on your hands. My fist clenches, and I wish for a spark, for flame, for something to burn. She knows what I want, and grins to herself. On the other side of the bars, her fingers tap against the air, alight with purple and white. The electric energy is a tease at best. Beyond my reach, beyond the sphere of silent stone. I ache for my ability the way I ache for Mare, for Thomas, for who I was supposed to be. At least I can admit when I'm wrong, she continues. When I make a mistake. When the horrible things I've done and will do are my own fault. The sparks reflect in her eyes. They shudder from brown to purple, giving her an unearthly look, like her gaze might run me through. Part of me wishes she would. I suppose you taught me that. Instead, I grin again. Then you should thank me properly. She responds in kind, spitting at my feet. At least some things in this world are still predictable. You never disappoint, I hiss, scraping my shoe against the cement floor. She doesn't waver. The tunnels. Heaving a breath, I pretend to be so desperately put upon. I make her wait, letting the silence stretch for several long, blistering moments. I take the time to look at her, to see Mare Barrow for who she is right now, not who I remember, and not who I wish she could be. Mine. But she doesn't belong to anyone, not even my brother. I take comfort in such a small consolation. We're alone together, she and I. Our paths may be horrible, but they're the paths we made for ourselves. The golden glow of her skin is warm, even down here, illuminated by the harsh light of fluorescence. She is so stubbornly alive, still burning like a candle fighting against rain. Fine. I give her what she wants. I think it's what I want, too. Their plan was always to kill me, after I ceased to be useful. I'm not surprised, it's what I'd do. Still, when the cloth is pulled off my head, revealing the mountains bold around us, I can't help but feel afraid. If I'm allowed to see this place, see Montfort and its capital, then I am well and truly dead. It's only a matter of time. The air is cold, biting at my exposed face. My shivers of fear are more than warranted. I blink up at the purple sky, hazed before dawn, streaked with the light of a distant sunrise creeping over the mountain peaks. Snow clings to the heights, even in summer. Quickly, I try to get my bearings. The city of Ascendant reaches into the valley below, sweeping over the slopes to an alpine lake. It doesn't remind me of any city I've seen, not in Norta or even the Lakelands. This place is too new, but somehow old at the same time. Grown among the trees and the rocks, a part of this strange land as much as a human-built place. But the city doesn't matter. I'll never come back here. Not if I escape, nor if they execute me. There is simply no reality where I return to Montfort. We're standing near a runway, cut evenly between two mountains. The smell of jet fuel is sharp on the otherwise fresh air. Several air jets line up on the paved straightaway, ready to take flight. I squint over the heads of the guards around me, glimpsing a white palace in the distance, looking down at the capital. That must be where I was taken before, when I was dragged before that strange council of reds, silvers, and new bloods. The faces hemming me in are unfamiliar, their uniforms equally split between Montfort green and the hellish red of the Scarlet Guard. They keep me locked in place, unable to do much more than stand on my toes for a craning look at the crowd. For this is certainly a crowd. Dozens of soldiers and their commanders, organized into neat lines, wait patiently for the jets. But far fewer than I expected. Do they really think this is enough to assault Archaon? Even if they have new bloods of strange and terrible abilities, this is foolish. Suicide. How did I lose to such rampant idiots? Someone chuckles nearby, and I'm seized by the familiar sense that they're laughing at me. I turned sharply, only to see the Premier of Montfort himself staring between the shoulders of my guards. With a gesture of his hand, the two soldiers move, allowing him to approach. To my surprise, he's dressed like a soldier, unremarkable in a dark green uniform. No medals or honors on his breast, nothing to mark him as the leader of an entire country. No wonder he and Cal got along so well. They're both stupid enough to fight on the front lines. "Something funny," I sneer, looking up at him. The Premier merely shakes his head. As in the council, the man keeps his face still and almost empty, showing only enough emotion to allow an audience to project their own assumptions. I would congratulate him on the talent if I felt so inclined. Like me, Davidson is a skilled actor. But his performance is wasted. I see through him. What happens when this is over, and the time comes to divide the spoils? I smile, the air freezing against my teeth. Who picks up my brother's crown, Davidson? The man doesn't flinch, seemingly unaffected. But I catch the minuscule twitch as his eyes narrow. Look around, Kalor. No one wears crowns in my country. So clever, I muse. Not all crowns are worn where people can see. He smirks, refusing to rise to the bait. Either his temper is extraordinary, or somehow this man is truly without a lust for power. It's the former, of course. No person on earth can ignore the lure of a throne. Uphold your end of the bargain, and it will be quick, the older man says, backing away. Board him, he adds, his voice harder in command. The guards move as one, well trained. And if I shut my eyes, I could pretend they were sentinels, my own silver protectors, oathed to keep me safe, instead of these rats and blood traitors bent on keeping me chained. At least they don't bother with manacles. My wrists remain unbound, albeit bare. No bracelets, no flame. No sparks that I can make. Lucky, then, that we're traveling with a lightning girl. I managed to catch a glimpse of her as I marched forward, over the runway to the air jet idling ahead. She clusters with her friend, the Farley woman, who was so easily misled a year ago, as well as her fellow electrocon, the white-haired man. Odd hair must be a style in Montfort, because there's a woman with blue locks and a man with closely cut green hair as well. Mare smiles at them, a true grin. When she moves, I realize her hair is different too. The gray ends are gone, replaced by a beautiful, familiar purple. I love it. I feel a tug deep in my chest. She's on my jet, probably to keep an eye on me, to let her torturer friend stand over me for the entire flight. That's fine. I'll suffer it. A few hours of fear are worth the dwindling time we have left. Our jet has dark green wings, a symbol of the Montfort fleet. I'm led up and into a military craft lined with seats, plus a lower compartment running the length of the fuselage, for more passengers or arms, maybe both. My mouth turns sour as I realize this jet is Montfort-made, and certainly not the only one. The strange mountain country is better equipped than we realized, even after Corvium, after Harbor Bay, and they are mobilizing. As I'm strapped into my seat, the buckles fastened just a hair too tight, I realize why Davidson was laughing. The jets on the runway, the soldiers assembled outside, they're just the beginning. How many thousands are you leading into Archeon? I ask aloud, letting my voice carry over the bustle of the filling compartment. I'm ignored, and that's answer enough. Across the jet, Mare takes her own seat with Farley at her side. The pair of them glance at me, eyes hard as flint, and just as easy to spark. I fight the urge to wag my fingers at them. Then a body crosses my vision, blocking the two women out. I heave a sigh and look up slowly. So predictable. "Try something," the white-haired electricon says. Instead, I shut my eyes and lean back. "Shan't," I reply, doing my best to hide how difficult it is to breathe against these infernal belts. He doesn't move, even when the jet roars into the air. So I keep my eyes shut, and I run through my precarious plan. Again and again and again.
32. Evangeline. It's been at least 2 weeks since Barrow left, a week since my betrothed was crowned king, and a few days since I saw Elaine last. I can still feel her, though, her pale skin smooth and cool beneath my fingers. But she is far, far beyond my reach. Dispatched back to the ridge, away from the danger. Cal would have let me keep her here if my father had allowed it. In spite of everything, an understanding is falling into place between us. Funny, I used to dream of such a thing. A king who left me to my own devices and my own crown. Now it's the best I can hope for, and a prison all the same. It traps us both, locking us away from the ones we care about most. He can't bring back Mare, and I won't bring Elaine back. Not with the Lakelander queens on the horizon, and an invasion imminent. I won't risk her life for a few days of my own comfort. My new rooms in Whitefire Palace are meant for the queen, and they still echo with the presence of Iris Signet. Everything is blue, 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 from the curtains to the plush carpets, even down to the flowers wilting in an obscene amount of crystal vases. With fewer servants, the process of clearing the rooms is slow-going. I end up ripping down most of the curtains myself. They're still in the salon outside my bedroom, collecting dust in a pile of cobalt blue silk. The long balcony overlooking the river is the only respite from her. The distant princess who will return to kill us all. And even here, standing with my face to the sun, I can't escape the thought of the Signet nymph. The capital river courses below, splitting the city of Archaon in two as it winds toward the sea. I try to ignore the rush of water, calm as it is. I focus on braiding my hair instead, pulling the silver strands back from my face. The simple act is a good distraction. The tighter the braids, the more severe, the more determined I feel. I plan to train a little this morning, go through the motions, run the barracks track, maybe spar with Ptolemus if he wants. I find myself wishing Barrow were here. She's a good workout and a good challenge, and easier to deal with than my mother. I'm surprised she hasn't breezed in yet, as she often does these days, trying to prod me toward more queenly activities, as she puts it. But I don't have the stomach to charm or intimidate nobles today, especially for her benefit. My parents want me to sway more silvers, earn the loyalty they pledged to Cal, to pull allies away from him, like saving rats from a sinking ship. Mother and father want me to be his queen the way Iris was Maven's, a snake in his bed, a wolf at his side, gathering strength and waiting for an opportunity to strike. Even though I do not care for Cal, and never could, somehow it feels wrong. But if Annabelle and Julian play out their scheme, I have no idea where that leaves me. Suspended on a bridge, trapped in the middle, with both ends on fire. The bridge. My hands drop, leaving half my hair undone, and I squint at the massive structure spanning the river. The other side of Archaon gleams beneath the rising sun, its many buildings crowned with steel and bronze birds of prey. Nothing seems amiss. It's still busy with transports and a roving populace. So is the bridge, all three levels of it bustling with traffic. Less than usual, but that's to be expected. It's the supports below that worry me, and the water breaking around them. still steady, moving at the same speed. But the current, the wash of white breakwater at each base, the river is flowing the wrong way. And it's rising. I fly through my bedchamber and the adjoining rooms, seeing nothing until I reach Ptolemus's quarters. The locked door unlatches without a thought, blowing back on twisted hinges as I sprint through. I barely hear myself shout his name. The buzzing in my head is far too loud, overwhelming everything but the cold, acid rush of adrenaline. He stumbles out into the sitting room toward me, half-dressed. I catch a glimpse of rumpled bedsheets through the door behind him, as well as a blue-black arm. It moves, pulling out of sight, as Ren Skonos busies herself with her clothes.
"What is it?" my brother asks, his eyes wide with panic. I want to run. I want to scream. I want to fight. The invasion.
How could they do this? Move their army without us knowing?
Ptolemus dogs at my heels, barely keeping pace as we stalk through the palace halls. Galleries, salons, receiving chambers, and even ballrooms blur at the edge of my vision. In a few hours, it could all be destroyed, burned or drowned or simply erased. For a moment, I see my brother's corpse, broken and sprawled across the intricate marble floor, his blood like a mirror. I blink, fighting off the thought. Bile rises in my mouth anyway. I glance back at him, alive and breathing, towering in his armor, if only to convince myself he's still here. Ren follows, her healer's uniform clearly marked. I hope they stay together over the next few hours. I would tie her to him if I could. We had eyes on their citadels, I mutter, speaking to keep myself focused. We knew the Lakelands were gathering for something, but not when. Ren's voice is slow and steady, but not soothing. They must have gone north, moved overland.
Without the Scarlet Guard, we don't have many eyes left in the Lakelands.
Ptolemus curses as we round another corner, angling for the throne room. Our parents haven't found us yet, and that can only mean they're with the king and his advisors. They must already know. Laraland guards open the doors for us, putting their lethal hands to the tall lacquered panels. We march past together, the three of us keeping a tight formation on the off chance the Lakelanders have already infiltrated the city. My ability buzzes, flung wide to catch any errant bullets. I count the rounds in the guards' guns, letting them hang at the edge of my perception as we cross the floor. At the raised platform containing Cal's throne, as well as the seats for his uncle and grandmother, the royals collect. Mother and father are here, with the latter armored as usual. Sunlight flashes off him with every small movement, and he is almost blinding to look at. Mother is more subdued,